We are in an unofficial official meeting, I guess you'd say. We're in the interim, so we're not in the official legislative session, but obviously our committee is authorized to meet in the interim. We are meeting today. The subject is gang violence. Certainly, there have been other hearings held by the mayor's task force, the faith-based community, certainly the municipality of Anchorage. The police department has done a lot in this regard. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear about some of the efforts that are underway and also to look at what the state's role should be in helping to address this. There are gaps in the solution that involve state initiative, and whether it comes from the House or the Senate, there's no pride of authorship here. It's simply that our committee had discussed this earlier and we had committed to holding hearings in the interim. So that's what we're doing here today. I'm going to go first to, we have a number of folks to testify, but I've already explained I'm going to go to a legislative aide for Congressman Adam Schiff, because he has a time constraint, and take his testimony. And his last name, I apologize, it's Philip, and I cannot pronounce the last name. So if you, Philip, if you're there, if you could pronounce your last name. And then just present for the record, Representatives Dahlstrom, Anderson, Lynn, Guerra, Coghill, Wilson, and Representative Pete Cott is on the line as well. So thanks to everybody who's here today, and I'll go ahead and take Philip's testimony if you're there. Can you hear me, Philip?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
It's Philip Tatakran.
There you go.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding the growing problem of gang violence across our communities and recent efforts by the United States Congress to address this issue. As Legislative Director and Counsel to United States Representative Adam Schiff, who represents a number of communities in the Los Angeles area, I've had the opportunity to examine this issue and to work on legislation that the Congressman has introduced to crack down on criminal street gangs. Criminal street gangs continue to proliferate in communities across the country, with substantial increases in the number of cities and counties with gang problems between the mid-1980s and also the mid-1990s. Gangs are not a new phenomenon in the Los Angeles area. There are more than 700 gangs in the city of Los Angeles, with a combined membership of over 39,000 individuals. During the last 5 years, there were over 40,000 violent gang crimes in the city, including close to 1,500 homicides and over 15,000 felony assaults. In the last few years, the Los Angeles area has experienced an epidemic of youth violence that is rapidly spreading from the inner cities to the suburbs. The gang problem, however, is not only a California issue. In fact, the most recent comprehensive national gang estimates indicate that there were over 731,000 gang members in 21,500 gangs in over 2,000 major cities across the United States in 2002. Although concerns about gangs and gang-related violence were initially isolated to inner-city urban areas, today the concern has shifted to include violent gang activities that have moved into rural and suburban areas. The increased activity and recent migration of violent California-based gangs have only heightened these concerns about the spread of gangs. One of the most notorious of these gangs has now surfaced up and down the East Coast of the nation in areas such as Long Island, New York, the Washington, D.C. area, and even Charlotte, North Carolina. Gang crime has traditionally been a state and local law enforcement issue, with the federal role limited to grant programs to state and local law enforcement and community-based agencies. As gangs continue to migrate geographically, increase in sophistication, and expand the types of illegal activities they engage in, such as money laundering and complex drug enterprises, Congress has expressed new interest in the issue. Recognizing that the gang problem is no longer a local issue, but a national one requiring a national strategy, anti-gang legislation has been introduced in both the United States Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. I would like to discuss with you one such piece of legislation that I have had the opportunity to work on for Congressman Schiff. the Gang Prevention and Effective Deterrence Act, H.R. 970, introduced by Congressman Schiff, is a bipartisan bill designed to increase gang prosecution and prevention efforts by bringing together federal, state, and local law enforcement, providing them with new tools to combat gang violence, and making available new funds to keep kids out of gangs to begin with. The Congressman's legislation is virtually identical to a bill introduced by Senators Feinstein and Hatch that was reported out of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee in the last Congress and has since been reintroduced. Street gangs are increasingly focusing on running full-service criminal enterprises in the neighborhoods where they reside, showing increasing levels of sophistication and exhibiting characteristics common to organized crime. Since they will likely continue to expand these criminal enterprises in new ways and places throughout this country, this requires new and creative ways to attack this problem. In 2002, the city of Los Angeles announced that it would begin going after street gangs in the same way law enforcement brought down traditional organized crime figures, using the federal racketeering statute, or RICO, to its full capacity. However, these racketeering laws were designed to prosecute organized crime with mafia-style organizations in mind. The Gang Prevention and Effective Deterrence Act would create a similar tool, but tailored specifically to violent street gangs by criminalizing violent crimes in furtherance or in aid of criminal street gangs. The most lucrative criminal enterprise for street gangs has been the retail distribution of illicit narcotics. Congressman Schiff's legislation would attack this problem by making murder and other violent crimes committed in connection with drug trafficking a federal crime. Street gangs also engage in a host of other criminal endeavors, and the use of firearms is a major feature of gang violence, with gang members far more likely than other delinquents to carry guns and to use them. Congressman Schiff's legislation increases penalties for criminal use of firearms in crimes of violence and drug trafficking. The bill also allows for the detention of persons charged with firearms who have been previously convicted of crimes of violence or serious drug offenses. These new federal crimes and tougher sentences are aimed at deterring violent gang-related crime. They are also aimed at encouraging greater cooperation from gang members who are facing long jail time with prosecutors, which could lead to the identification, arrest, and prosecution of other gang members. These are important steps in order to successfully tear down these criminal gang networks. Such measures are strongly supported by a host of law enforcement officials who are seeking tougher sentences to stop gang violence. Unfortunately, gangs have strong links to youth in our country. The FBI has reported that 819 juvenile gang killings occurred in 2003, up from 580 several years before. And law enforcement agencies report that the problem is getting worse. Our youth are being held hostage by gangs. Gang involvement takes a heavy toll on adolescent social development and life course experiences, the end result often being continued involvement in criminal activity throughout adolescence and into adulthood. In order to effectively prosecute an entire gang, it is sometimes necessary to prosecute multiple defendants in the same case, including juvenile gang members. The Gang Prevention and Effective Deterrence Act proposes a limited reform of the juvenile justice system to facilitate federal prosecution of 16 and 17-year-old gang members who commit serious acts of violence. Congressman Schiff's legislation, finally, also provides more resources to bolster the fight against gangs and attempt to attack the problem at its roots. The bill authorizes approximately $650 million over the next 5 years to support federal, state, and local law enforcement efforts against violent gangs, including the funding of witness protection programs and for intervention and prevention programs for at-risk youth. The bill also increases funding for federal prosecutors and FBI agents to increase coordinated enforcement efforts against violent gangs. This is an important section of the bill. Congressman Schiff strongly believes that tough deterrence and enforcement measures must also be coupled with crucial prevention provisions. When the congressman took office in the California State Senate before arriving in the U.S. Congress, he introduced a host of anti-crime measures. At the same time, he realized then, as he does now, that we must also take steps to intervene immediately and address juvenile crime at its roots to prevent young people from getting into trouble. Indeed, the congressman believes we can pay now or we can pay later. A small amount of prevention funding invested now can save a lot down the road. When a juvenile is incarcerated in California, for example, it costs the state $90,000 a year. Investing a small amount on the front end in tested, research-based programs that keep kids out of trouble makes a lot of sense, both in terms of dollars saved and lives saved. Over the last 2 years, Congress has acted on anti-gang legislation on more than one occasion. The House of Representatives has passed similar legislation, and negotiations with the Senate are ongoing with hopes that comprehensive anti-gang legislation can be agreed upon by both chambers in the near future. Madam Chair, thank you again for the opportunity to testify to the committee today and to share some of the federal legislative developments in this area.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions from the committee? So, are there significant differences between your legislation and the other party's legislation, or do they parallel each other fairly closely?
The majority version of the legislation that passed on the House side has a few significant differences. Congressman Schiff's legislation is virtually identical to the bipartisan version on the Senate side, however.
Okay. Great. Questions? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Philip, what are some of the ideas for some of the prevention programs? Is it things that are already in the works, or are we going to have to really think outside the box and try to think of some new ways to do this?
Under the bill, it is tailored towards existing programs. However, there's an ability for states to apply for grants for programs that have, you know, that had demonstrated results. But I think the congressman definitely believes that folks should always, you know, think outside the box in this area. But there has definitely been an emphasis, at least on the national level, that such funding be given to, you know, tested, research-based programs.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Sir, I've got just a question to see if you know anything about this issue of counseling to divert kids away from gang-related activities. The other day I sat down with our police chief and our outgoing police chief, and they were very heavy on this issue of trying to find kids at middle school age when they're first getting interested in gangs to try and figure out a way to identify at-risk youth and get them into counseling, sort of counseling on how to sort of avoid being grabbed into the gang culture. And my first reaction was I didn't know if there was a science like that, if there was counseling like that. And they assured me that there was, and they gave me the name of a local person. But can you comment on whether or not there is a sort of counseling that works that way that would be effective? Do you talk about the gang prevention provisions of the bill, and I assume that must be one of them.
Then all of a sudden it went. So
through the chair, I'm not familiar with the specific use of counseling. However, the idea that reaching kids at the middle school age is definitely something that is strongly supported by evidence, the benefits of doing that, and is something that the bill is definitely supports. But this can be a range of programs, not necessarily a counseling program per se.
Just one follow-up. You know, what I want to avoid, I mean, there's always this sort of tough on, we'll make this a crime, we'll make that a crime, we'll put people in jail for a longer approach, which sometimes is appropriate, but that doesn't solve the biggest problem, which is the growing number of kids who are becoming gang members. And so I guess if it's not counseling that you're familiar with, what is it that you propose we focus on to try and minimize the number of kids who are becoming interested in gangs and a gang culture, because it's the kids who are becoming gang members and getting interested in it that's really, I think, the root of what we have to focus on to stop this problem, rather than catching the few people we're going to catch after they do it.
Through the chair, I think you're absolutely right, and it really is something that where we rely upon the experts to decide which programs are working and which are not. Which is it, an after-school program? Is it a counseling program? Which program really has demonstrated results? When the congressman was in the California State Senate, he passed a bill that became law called the Schiff-Cardenas Juvenile Justice Prevention Bill. It basically said, we are going to provide additional funds to localities throughout the state that they can apply for to increase frontline law enforcement, something that almost every county was interested in. Mm-hmm. However, the bill said, if you avail yourself of that funding, 50% of it must be used for prevention programs. A study of the program, both in-state and an independent study by RAND, showed demonstrated results of age group samples compared to age group samples of kids who did not go through any of these programs. And it showed very, very strong results that I'd be happy to provide to the committee.
Yeah, that would be great. In the summary sheet that I have for the bill for H.R. 970, it has two bullet points on the second page that stipulates that the bill will authorize funding of $500 million for suppression and intervention for gang violence enforcement teams, and then to provide community-based programs for crime prevention and intervention services for gang members and at-risk youth in areas designated as high-intensity interstate gang activities. And then it goes on to talk about Project Safe Neighborhoods programs and so on. But I think Representative Guerra brings up a good point. It's always interesting in these bills, and just something to keep your eye on the federal level, whether it's No Child Left Behind, whether it's tobacco cessation programs and so on. We always start out with the idea that there's going to be money behind these efforts, and then pretty soon, you know, you're 10 years down the line and the money stream is no longer there. And when it comes to crimes in particular, you've got the stringent penalties, but suddenly the intervention programs and the money that comes with it behind that goes away. So I think he makes a good point, which is that, I think the ultimate goal, obviously, if people are committing these crimes, then they are, and we've got to prosecute them. But if there's a method or a way in our community to try and get to these young people early enough, to give them an alternative to that life, that's certainly better. So just keeping your eye on that, that's something that I would assume the congressman from his state background would be interested in that as well, but that's something that concerns me too.
I will definitely take that back to federal policymakers.
Okay, without further ado, Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. I represent an area that is a fairly high crime area. My name is Max Gruenberg. I'm a member of the committee. And we're concerned in Mountain View about the fact that very few police officers live in areas that are high crime. And I've introduced legislation in the past to allow municipalities to provide tax incentives to peace officers who buy and live in their own homes in such areas, because people who live there and are a presence 24 hours a day will deter crime. Do you have any thoughts on the possibility of beneficial effects of such legislation?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that actually sounds like a very interesting proposal. And while I can't cite any specific data that I've seen, it would seem to make sense, and from what we've heard about community policing efforts, that an individual who is familiar with the area and lives in the area would probably be more effective in especially reaching out to the youth, troubled youth in that area?
Well, I would make a similar offer to the offer you've made to us, that if you'd like to explore that at the, you know, in incorporating that into your federal model or anything like that, my staff and I'd be happy to assist you.
Through the chair, yes, I would love to follow up with you.
Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under Title I, Section 114, it talks about the reauthorization of the gang resistance education and training programs, project programs. The reauthorization makes it sound to me like it's been going for a while. And is there an accompanying report that goes with that that gives us some principles that they've been operating under?
Through the chair, yes, and actually an interesting development was that piece of the bill was actually signed into law by the president. Representative Schiff attached it to the Department of Justice reauthorization bill. So that has been enacted. The GREAT program is similar to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the DARE program, which addresses a drug problem and sends law enforcement into classrooms to talk to students about drugs. And I can provide you with additional information and background on that program.
If that could be given to the committee, I think that would help us at least look at it from the larger picture. And I think that would be good for some of the basic principles that we're going to be digging into. Thank you.
Absolutely. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, sir. I have a question. In the last few years, probably really 5 to 8 years, there's been a lot of research done on early childhood development and finding that if children aren't introduced to language and a lot of speaking back and forth with the parents and read to various other things, that by the time they get to school, that it's already kind of set in cement. The teachers can tell by third grade whether how they're going to do the whole rest of the time. Now, the fact that we know that if some of these pathways in the brain aren't used, they actually disappear. And that's why they can't catch up sometimes. Sometimes they can never catch up. If we would look at prevention in that area and make sure that children, by the time they reach school age, and many times it is minorities, and I don't know what you found with the gang violence. I have no idea whether what the percentages are as far as whites and minorities and things like that. But many times it could go clear back to when they were growing up that they didn't have they weren't spoken to just because of culture differences and things like that. And it makes a difference for that child the rest of their life. And I'm wondering if anybody has looked into that aspect to see if we can help these kids feel confident about themselves and that they can go ahead and become something of and make something of their life so that they wouldn't even think of some of this other gang-related activities. Is there any research that's been done on that or anything?
Through the chair, I'm sure that there is research on that topic. I'm not sure that it's specifically tailored to gang activity, but indeed, with regard to just delinquency later in life. And I can try to track down some good studies and provide that to you.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we have Captain Cobb and Lieutenant Hahnemann to present an overview of a gang brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to our committee, and thank you for your patience.
Right. Thank you for inviting us. This is a problem in our community, as we all know. The community is demanding action, and we're only going to get control of this if we all work together at the local, state, and the federal level and the community. And that's me. I've been a police officer now for 21 years with the Anchorage Police Department. I spent most of my career in the operations side of it, patrol commander, canine SWAT, school resource officer, lieutenant, which I'm proud of.
Wow.
And 11 months in personnel, which was a very, very dark time. for me. Recently, I've been promoted to captain of detectives. It's my responsibility to coordinate the gang response for the Anchorage Police Department. And initially, I got involved in this back when I was a school resource officer lieutenant. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Next slide, please. What I'd like to talk about today, and I've got a lot of material to cover, so I'm going to go very quickly through it, but I'll stay afterwards if anybody has any questions. And I want to save some time so we can have a dialogue because I think that's important. I want to talk about the nationwide gang problem and some definitions so we're all kind of on the same page, a history of our gang problem, what our local gang problem looks like today, some concerns we have about the responses in place today, some possible solutions, and then I'll entertain some questions. And as you can see, and you just got some stats from that gentleman on the from Washington, D.C., that are different from the stats we have from the FBI 2005 congressional testimony. And the reason that is because there is no nationwide database that tells you how many gang members or how many gangs there are. What you're looking at there is the best estimates. And you can see quite a difference from 1996 to present day, and the reason being I think a lot of the cities and departments were in denial like we were here in the early to mid-90s. Next slide, please. And this is the reason why we need to be concerned. This is the reason why we were concerned at the Anchorage Police Department, because we could see with the level of violence, the level of sophistication of weapons, the number of rounds being exchanged between the different groups here, that was just a matter of time before innocent people were in the wrong place at the wrong time. If you read a recent Anchorage Daily News article, they had some numbers there that weren't quite accurate, but needless to say, there have been several innocent people that have been caught in the crossfire. Not to mention some of the kids who get involved in this lifestyle and are on the periphery and end up getting shot, maimed, killed. So what is a gang? Well, there's a state definition for a gang, and that's the beginning of up right there. Three or more persons who have a common name, symbol, tattoo, or other physical style of dress. Well, that could be my girl's soccer team, right? So what's the difference between my girl's soccer team and one of these criminal street gangs? Well, I'd like to think a pattern of criminal activity, which is next. And you see they have some numbers here, and this is our state definition, preceding 3 years, two or more offenses under the following groups. And then we have a federal definition, which is a little bit different. You know, five or more people, one crime, kind of the same thing, a little twist. But there's no definition that I know of, state or federal, that defines what a gang member is. And at the Anchorage Police Department, our intel session, in our intel unit, we've looked at different policies from around the country. We have criteria there, and we tie it into criminal activity or possible criminal activity, and we use that to validate gang members or associates. We just don't go say, you know, you're a gang member, because, you know, we have criteria there that we go by in our intel unit. You hear us talk on the in the press a lot of times about gang-related or gang-motivated. What's the difference? Well, gang-related means any type of any crime that involves a gang member, whether he's the victim, the suspect, a witness, somewhere, somehow, we have a validated gang member or associate involved in that type of crime. And gang-motivated? Gang-motivated is a crime that's committed for the benefit of that group, for the protection of the members. They come together. And next slide, please. In Anchorage, we have mostly gang-related crime, and that's not based on any numbers. It's not accurate. In fact, I would say the slice that represents gang-motivated is probably smaller than what's shown right there. What we have in Anchorage, for the most part, a lot of these high-profile crimes that you hear about on the news involve things that kids and youth and young adults have fought over for years when we were in high school. I look around and see a couple that are probably in high school when I was close there. We used to have fights once in a while. People would have disagreements. They'd shake hands later. That's not the case anymore. The case is they bring their friends. One's got a club. The other one's got a gun. And pretty quick, the bullets are flying. Next slide. So what's the gang problem look like nationwide? We don't talk about local gangs because we don't want to give them the press for the most part, help them recruit. But here are some of the groups outside. The ones that you see that have the dark borders are ones that where we have elements, or they're here. Pretty much you can see like a lot of things, some bad things have come up in the lower 48, mainly Chicago, L.A. You've got the Crip Bloods from L.A., folk people, and these are sets. They're umbrella groups, and we have a lot of local groups that claim allegiance underneath these groups, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Next slide. Here are some of the lower 48 imports that we have up here. In the first four, Bloods, Crips, folks, people, we have a lot of local groups that claim affiliation under these general national sets. Hell's Angels, of course, we have them from Anchorage, and from time to time you'll see some national news where they the FBI or someone or the state has taken action against them, but they're for the most part pretty low profile, focused on business here within the city. White supremacists, we have a few around here.
Can I stop you real quick and ask one question?
Sure.
Are you finding that there is a member from another state that will come up to Alaska and sort of initiate the organization, or is it that you have young people within a community that through the internet or other things identify with one of these groups and then begin that process, or how does that?
We have both. Okay. Back in the early 90s when the TRG, Tiny Rascal Gang, mainly comprised of Southeast Asian individuals, a guy from Long Beach, California that was a TRG member came up and started that. And they were responsible for some mayhem back in then. And then our most, couple of our most violent gangs were started in a little, we were starting in a middle school here in towns, a group of friends. They grew, they had disagreements, they split, and then they had multiple shootings around town. We'll talk about that a little bit more.
Representative Guerra.
Can you just tell me, obviously the thing that makes gangs dangerous is dangerous weapons, right? And there's always a tussle in the state about what weapons people should have, what weapons they shouldn't have. Is there a law right now that says under a certain age you shouldn't be able to have a weapon that would be used other than for, let's say, hunting or something like that?
What is it, 17? Under 16, I believe.
Under 16?
I believe, yeah.
And under 16, you can't have a weapon that is primarily used for violence, I suppose, or something like that? Or
maybe. Go ahead, Paul.
Under the state law, through the chair, Representative Guerra, under the state law, currently it's under 16 unless you're with your parents providing a weapon like you're hunting or you're out on a sports competition or such. There's federal law that says you cannot sell from a retailer, licensed gun dealer or retailer under age 21. But if a person, an individual, wanted to sell their gun in the newspaper or personally to another person, there is no legislation either at the federal or the state level that prohibits it. So possession, mere possession under age 16 under state law currently, unless with a parent or guardian.
So what about a hunting rifle? Let's say a shotgun.
It's all firearms. Yes.
So under 16, not allowed to have a firearm except in the presence of an adult. And is that okay, or should that be changed?
There's some adjustments that I believe will be forthcoming.
That's one of the things we looked at. I think it's it's my position, and I believe it's the chief's position. Also, and I'll find out if it's not.
You'll hear later.
Right. Law-abiding citizens we're not concerned about. Youth and people involved in this type of lifestyle we're very concerned about. We don't want them anywhere near guns, and we think that probably would be a nice thing if we had the latitude within the city here to make that so.
Just to follow up, through the chair, you have a local product at local high school. Years ago, we used to carry live 22 long rifles for rifle classes sanctioned in the school. They've since switched to air rifles, which tell us. But kids used to carry their long gun cases, sometimes even on the school buses. We drive them to school in our cars. It was not prohibited. It wasn't generally a problem. Since several things in society have changed, that has become an issue. Again, echoing what Captain said, I know that there's some recommended legislation potentially coming before the next session by the end of the year.
And following up on that, is it primarily guns? Are there knives? What are the other?
Primarily guns, handguns. So the weapons are becoming more dangerous. You've probably been reading the paper about some of the incidents. You're seeing that we're having 223, rifle rounds exchanged out there. I think I might be off on this, but I think we had one where we suspect an automatic weapon was used. Semi-automatic handgun seems to be the mainstay for the most part. I mean, we do have clubs and knives. They're involved, but for the most part, it seems to be firearms. I think I was at the white supremacist. We do have a few of those around. Sons of Samoa, Pacific Islander group. We have a growing concern about the activity within that community. SIR 13 is a Sorrentos 13. It's a Southern California Hispanic gang. I think last time I checked, it was the largest by membership on the West Coast. We do have a few members up here. However, it's not that high profile in Anchorage. And, of course, we talked about Tiny Rascal Gang. That flag that you saw there came out of one of our high schools.
Wow.
I'll kind of let you read these next series of slides, and then we'll comment on them.
May I just ask a question?
Representative Gruenberg, yes.
It would be really helpful. Do you have hard copies of your, if you could distribute those, so
yes.
We could have those, that would be really good.
Thank you. Yeah. There isn't anything in it that isn't public, obviously, information.
Well, there's a couple things I'd prefer not to.
Okay.
They have checked, but, you know, most of it's public, and it's kind of late now.
If you wanted to give it to my aide and
right.
maybe flag those things that you
right.
prefer,
okay.
that would be fine.
Okay. We don't like to use the term wannabe because you're either a gang member or an associate or you're not. You're one or the other. You're either dead or you're not. So, next slide. So you see, we're not alone with this problem. You know, Las Vegas, Jacksonville, in fact, every city over 250,000 has a gang problem. And most of them are similar to ours. We're not like Chicago and L.A. where we have the traditional, what we call predatory gangs that have change commands, turf, that are pretty well organized, profit-based for the most part. We have a different type of group, and we'll talk about that here shortly. But I just put this slide up here because it kind of mirrors, and you're going to see as we go along in this presentation, and I give you some more information about what our local problem looks like, kind of mirrors what we're facing here. Certainly, I was listening to the testimony about 39,000 gang members, I think he said,
yeah.
in L.A., 15,000, did he say, or 1,500, I guess, 1,500 homicides.
Yeah.
You know. Mm. Here's what we, through our intel unit, and, of course, intel is very important when you're dealing with this type of issue because you need to know what groups are out there, who's a member of the group, who the leadership is, so we can target them, who the most violent members are, so we can target them as law enforcement. Of course, our primary mission is suppression.
Mm-hmm.
However, we're fully support to the idea, you know, that there's intervention and prevention. And while intervention and prevention, we're going to be continually doing suppression, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But certainly, suppression is an important part of it. We need to get these thugs that have no regard for human life off the street, out of the community, for a considerable amount of time so the intervention and prevention part of it can work.
And just on that point briefly, we talk in this committee about child molestation as an example of a category of crime that tends not to be, or of criminals, very difficult to rehabilitate. Would you say that this category of criminals is in the category that can be rehabilitated if done in a certain way?
Well, I'm not an expert in that area, but I will tell you that my personal opinion is you've got to start early on the intervention prevention. We're seeing recruitment down in the elementary area, you
okay.
know, fifth and sixth grade.
Gee.
And I think the majority of our focus for the program should be at a very young age. And unlike L.A. and Chicago, where you have second, third generation gang members raising kids, we're starting to see that a little bit here, but that's not a big problem with us yet, but the efforts need to be at a young age. I think by the time most young men and women get into high school, they're pretty well set, and it's only going to be a life-changing event, such as a death of a friend, something significant that maybe will open them to change at that point. Doesn't mean we don't try, but I think the majority of my opinion, our efforts should be at a fairly young age. And
You're saying 11 years old.
We've had some reports of, yes, in the fifth and sixth grade, that area of recruitment.
Through the chair on that topic,
yeah.
I had made a commentary, if I may, and that is, to echo that comment, the greatest challenge we're faced with in our society in general across the nation, Alaska and Anchorage, of course, being no different, is that the community condemnation, the message that the community, the state, and all the communities have to send towards gangs or the tolerance of gangs or the lack of tolerance for gangs is the most strongest and powerful message. And the example is, recently we had a death sentence on a notorious murderous gang member in California, Tukey Williams, I believe his name, and they, all the way to his death, you know, there's this experience of if you're injured, if you're shot, or if you're killed, that you're martyred in the community, and you're held in some esteem or regard. There's little crosses that they you'll see in later in the presentation. And so it's the message through sentencing, it's the message through laws, it's the message through parents, it's the message through groups that we send to the community that's going to essentially be the biggest difference in whether or not we'll have future problems with gangs or whether we can sign the addiction program.
And acceptance, right? I mean, isn't that part of it, too? It's wanting to be part of a group, wanting to be part, having a sense of self-worth. I think that's what Representative Guerra, Coghill, and Wilson were alluding to. It's that building that self-esteem and sense of community.
Well, that's part of it. There's several reasons, and unfortunately, some of them aren't so noble recently, and
okay.
We'll talk about that a little bit. You'll see in the bottom there, 450 suspected gang. That's just an estimate based on the reports that we're getting in so far. And you can see, to date, we've validated 130 gang members, 97 associates. We could validate more, but we've only got one person in intel we're short on, and that's from the counter-drug support program. The gentleman worked with Safe Streets in the past, and he was the intel analyst in the past with the Safe Streets program. I managed to snag him coming back from Uzbekistan, where he was activated, and he's a intel analyst by training, and so we're very fortunate, mm-hmm. and that's one thing that we appreciate the state helping us out on, and we intend to increase our staffing in that unit so we can get more timely data and get a better handle on the program. Next slide.
Yeah.
That kind of shows you the...
Representative Greenberg.
I'd like to go back to something you said a few minutes ago, Captain. Maybe you'll get into this, that how people get into gangs. And I understand that what you're saying is they tend to do this at their young age in middle school in that area.
Right.
And focusing on that, I'd like to ask two lines of questioning.
Sure.
Will the new unit, I guess it's fairly new, of police officers in the schools, is there anything that their presence in the schools can do to discourage that? And secondly, we have a statute called Contributing to the Delinquency of a Minor, and it applies to adults who contribute to the delinquency of a minor by encouraging or aiding or inducing anybody under the age of 18 to do something that's illegal. But I suspect that most of the people who encourage the kids to get into this are children themselves. And I'm wondering if there's anything that we can do to legally discourage somebody from inducing somebody else to join a gang, one young person from inducing another. Mm-hmm. And I realize those are two different.
Yeah, like a good defense attorney, I've got several questions there, and I'll try to answer them.
At your pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
No, that's good. That's one of the things that we want to do as we're going through is identify places where the state can play a role.
Right.
So whether it's changing the law or, as you said, obviously funding to increase enforcement in the intelligence unit. I'm making notes, and I know other members are too, mentally, of places the state can help.
Right. Well, Representative Gutenberg had some very good questions there. And, in fact, some of them were contained later in my presentation, but I'll address some of them right now. And why? And that was a question that Madam Chair asked a few minutes ago, and Representative Gar commented also. Self-esteem, wanting to be part of group is certainly part of the reason. However, this problem has come back on us from the early mid-90s, a more virulent strain, and part of it is because it's now ingrained in our culture. I don't see us ever, in my lifetime, getting rid of this problem. I don't think we're ever going to stamp it out in my lifetime because it's so ingrained in our culture right now, but certainly working together And with a two-pronged approach, we can get the violence down and we can get a lot better control of this situation. It used to be in the past, self-esteem, wanting to be part of a group, immigrants coming to a new country, feeling out of place, getting together for protection, for other reasons, we're certainly part of it. But today, because it's become such a part of our culture, you just need to watch MTV, VH1, some of the commercials with, like, Snoop Dogg used to be a gang member, and some of his lyrics and some of his songs refer to that. It's become popular for power, respect, are some of the reasons that kids from middle-class families involve themselves in these different type of groups. The School Resource Officer Program has been a big benefit, and it's certainly instrumental in our response to the gang problem. When I was lieutenant of the School Resource Officer Program back in 2003, when we went into the schools, that's where we started getting the information before the level of violence was up to where it is now. And that's where we started forming our intel unit. We could see the problem on the horizon, certainly with the information we were getting there. And from time to time, when we have violent incidents in our community, whether it be a homicide, a shooting back and forth between different groups, of course, what's represented in our communities, represented in our schools, unfortunately, and we have different groups in there, and sometimes when we have a shooting in the community or a homicide in the community, both those groups are representative, and sometimes relatives and friends of the suspects and victims are within the schools, and we get information of potential violence within the schools. We rearrange our staffing with school resource officers. In fact, in a couple of our high schools, we put in up to 5 officers there for a week or more, and work closely with the school administration, school safety, and the teachers to provide a high visibility and talk with members of different groups within those schools to make sure that we don't have the violence spill over into our schools. We've only had one significant incident that I'm aware of, gang-related violence, and that was several years ago at West High School. And I think it's a tribute to the program, to the school district administration, school safety, that with all the violence and the a lot of the people involved or in our school system or of school age, that we managed to keep the majority of the violence. And I think part of that goes back to Representative Gruenberg's question about school resource officers, their effectiveness. Mm-hmm. As far as contributing to the delinquency of a minor, recruiting, there are some statutes that we have, and I was going to talk about them at the end, involving gangs. However, I'm told by our prosecutors are difficult to use. Of course, recruiting and is a difficult thing to prove. The slide I have up now kind of shows the timeline. Back in the early 90s, there used to be a under 21 non-alcoholic club. Those are always a big draw for people involved in this type of lifestyle. We usually get a lot of violence around those type of establishments, no matter how the securities run there. We started seeing it at a place, Northern Lights and C Street, when I was a patrol officer years ago, and the initial reaction from the powers to be is we didn't have a gang problem. These are just wannabes. We're not going to acknowledge it, give them power. In fact, I don't know if it was an order or if it was just an urban legend that came down from the top, but I remember being told, you know, we wouldn't refer to drive-by shootings. We wouldn't use that terminology. We would refer to them as shooting from a mobile platform. So in the course, the violence didn't go away. We had some gangs form. That was back when we were talking about the TRGs earlier. We had a lot of shootings out on the strip, Northern Lights and Benson out in that area. We had gunfire exchange, people getting hurt. And so then we reversed gears at the police department. We had a zero tolerance, high profile thing. Of course, that we could only keep up that effort short term. It didn't solve the problem. It came back on us after that. And then we started to get serious about looking at it long term. We formed a gang unit. That didn't last too long because we rolled that into Safe Streets, which is a federal program involving different federal agencies and the police department. We use the federal statutes. We use the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it's very effective because the people that we catch involve drugs, guns, violence. They go away for a long, long time, and they're out of our community. And that unit, I believe, was pretty effective and it tamped down the violence below the radar screen. And, of course, once it was down below our radar screen, we kind of took our eyes off it, which was a mistake in hindsight, and a mistake that we intend not to repeat. Of course, 9/11 happened, and the majority of the resources for Safe Streets were diverted. Safe Streets pretty much ended on that day, but of course it officially ended back in 2002. In 2003, we started our school resource officer program. We started getting information that this problem was still with us and it was growing. And of course, Intel began. We got our Intel up running in about 2004. And then in the spring of 2005, we saw a rash of violence between the two groups I was talking about earlier. And we, at the police department and through the mayor's office, we understood at that point the way that we were traditionally responding to crime wasn't going to work. We had to change the way we do business and to deal with this problem. And so we started our campaign back in the spring of 2005. Next slide, please. This kind of shows you what I was just talking about there. That we have some groups. You'll notice between the timeline there in blue, 90s to 2006, that a lot of our gangs at that time kind of went out of business or because of prosecution or because they just change their names a lot. When we start putting pressure, they change their names or they break up for internal reasons, you know, and they form another group. But you'll notice gang 10, 11, and 11A down at the bottom. These were two groups that formed, we believe, back in that time when after State Streets was in its death throes there, the first one, and before the school resource officers came in, we started getting information about these groups. These two groups right here were a couple of the most violent groups, and they formed after our last effort. And next slide, please. To kind of illustrate that, we had our intel person go back for 19 months, research the all the felony shootings or felony assaults that we suspected that these two groups were in. And here you see the summary of that. You'll notice between October 03 and December of 04, we only had 13 cases in 14 months, so about one case a month. And then you'll see in the first 5 months of 2005 how the level of violence had spiked. We had 16 cases in 5 months. We basically had seven people that were injured by gunshot. We had two homicides, and at the height of it, between these two groups, they'd drawn in four or five different groups into their disagreement. Next slide, please. This just kind of illustrates more why we were concerned. These are just raw data here. You see that 2005 involving disturbances, assaults with weapons, misconduct with weapons. You'll see that, of course, the first 5 months of 2005 was the highest for the previous years. Next slide, please. We had talked about this earlier, the types of gangs. We get this from a gang expert out of Chicago. We had come up and instruct our people, and this is the terminology that he gave us and we use, and we'll talk briefly about them. Hmm. Predatory gang is more the organized gangs that you see. They have more of a chain of command, more of a monetary base for profit. Next slide. And here's what we face mostly in Anchorage right here. Scavenger gang, informal leadership change. The groups forms, reform under the same name, different names. Crimes are impulsive. Usually, you know, it's a fight over a girl, it's a fight over property, it's a fight over disrespect, which leads to a lot of these shootings. It's usually not a fight over turf, that someone from this group's in someone else's turf. It usually has to do with a fight over a girl or property. Next slide, please. And certainly the scavenger gangs are just as dangerous, more dangerous than the predatory gang people, because they react out of emotion and impulsively. Territorial, we're not seeing a lot of this yet. We're seeing some signs of it. There's been a couple assaults in a certain mall with people carrying the wrong color bandana, but we don't see any assaults yet that where someone's in the wrong community from another community and they involve different groups.
Could I ask a question?
Representative Kuhlenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's a scavenger gang?
scavenger gang is a term of a loosely formed group. They go under the same name. They don't have formal leadership. They react impulsively as opposed to like a motorcycle gang, like the Hell's Angel, that have leadership. They have goals. You know, they sit down, plan things out. This group reacts more impulsively. The group may be dealing drugs, but usually it's one or two members dealing drugs. It's not the whole group, you know, saying, you know, you go out here and do that. And so that's the difference between a scavenger and a predatory gang, or the more organized, the more the traditional type gang you think out of L.A. or Chicago. The scavenger gangs are the gangs that most of the communities of 250,000 or more, like in Jacksonville, Las Vegas, face. They face the same type of thing, where you've got a group of young men or women that form a group, call them a certain name, and for protection-wise and sometimes for other crimes, they'll band together, but they're not as organized as the predatory gang. Next group. Mm. And we talked about the Asian gang. Has a category of all its own because this group has some unique characteristics. They usually, the other gangs like to brag. They like the recognition. However, that's not the case with this type of gang. They usually work within their own community. A lot of time, these are new immigrant communities, so it's very difficult for us to figure out what's going on in that community because a lot of the elders in that community, they come from countries where the police aren't quite the caliber of where they are here. They have a natural fear. They don't know our customs. Sometimes there's language barriers, and so this makes it a very fertile and kind of easy ground for some of these groups to, and we're seeing a lot of the same characteristics here. This is one group where we're not sure the extent of it for just those reasons, but we know that we have elements here. This is what's kind of called the wannabe, and we don't use that term. Either you are or you're not. This is kind of the group that kind of hangs around, has a lot of information. And next slide. These are all local pictures here. Wow. Different groups. Next slide. You see the Pitchfork folk out of Chicago. You see the blue colors. You see the one up on the right-hand side, semi-automatic pistol pointing at you. Next one. Another a local group. This group is a kind of a diverse group. There's all individuals from different ethnic groups in this group. And from what I know, the only the gang problem cuts across all ethnic lines. The only group that isn't, we don't have a group that's essentially one ethnicity is, I don't see any Alaska Native gangs here that are basically Alaska Native. Otherwise, white, African American, Hispanic, it cuts across all ethnic towns. Graffiti. Sometimes we don't know the national lineup up here, local. Of course, you got folk and blood for life, and folk and blood don't go together. Usually. See a couple crosses there. I believe that's a couple members of that group that have passed away due to violent circumstances. Next group. Some of the different clothing styles you see around town. The camouflage there on the lower right-hand side is one of our local group's colors. You see some white supremacist stuff there. Some local tattoos, Mountain View, Crips, MTV. That's what that one tattoo stands for up there.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, 100%.
We've seen in the newspaper last few days, a real effort by some people I'd like to commend to help people remove tattoos.
Yeah.
Is that important in people who've want to get out of the gangs or outgrown the gangs or something? Is that something that
absolutely.
We should be assisting?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there any? Are you aware from your communications with police forces outside any communities that provide an avenue to assist people to remove tattoos and get out of the gangs? You know,
I'm not aware personally of any program like that. There may be, but I don't know of any.
I'd like you to think about that.
Okay. Next slide, please. Some more tattoos. LBC, Long Beach Crip, assaulted one of our officers. Some more Aryan Brotherhood tattoos, Black Gangster Disciple. Next slide, please. These individuals were arrested for a crime here, violent crime in Anchorage. Next slide. These are the colors. As you can see, blue and red are the primary colors, though, they're, you know, like I said, some of the local groups have different colors, like one of them, camouflage, is their primary color. Crips, if we go back, Crips, Folk, and Sir 13, usually see them in blue. Bloods, People, and Norteños, which is the northern version of Sir 13, are usually in red. Next slide, please. Some.
Representative Guerra?
I've actually got a question. Now that you mentioned the Aryan gangs a little bit, that a few years ago there was a guy who moved into town and made a big wave in the newspaper about how he was going to foment sort of anti-Semitic, anti-immigrant activity. Have those folks been involved in these gangs, or is that completely separate? Do those folks just sort of drop off ugly leaflets?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Some of them, I'd have to ask your question in general because I don't know the specifics of that. Some of them were probably in some of these Aryan groups, white supremacist groups, doing that type of activity. And we're going to talk about a second. I have a slide that kind of shows the difficulty and the problem we all face because of the general mindset in different segments of our community these days about how difficult this is going to be to get turned around. But I would, to answer your question, chances are probably, but I don't know for sure. The trends in the general area there, we're seeing, of course, increased violence. Used to be, back when I started in the early 90s, they used to shoot into the ground, shoot at the legs, a lot of part because they really didn't want to kill somebody, but that's not the case, of course, anymore. We're getting more powerful weapons out there, and they don't care. The gangs used to be a little more diverse up here back in the early 90s, but we're seeing to be more ethnically centralized now, though we are still more diverse in our gangs than some parts of the country. As we apply more pressure and as the popularities of these different groups, as the press and we apply more pressure, of course, they're going to deny that they're involved in the gang more and more. And, of course, we're seeing more gang-on-gang activity. Next slide, please. Here's what we're doing at the police department to respond to this problem. You'll see that we have a special assignment unit, which is six officers and a sergeant. Their primary duty is gang suppression when we don't have them doing other things. For instance, this week they're working on AFN for us. And below that, you'll see that we have the intel unit. Right now we have one person in there, and we intend to increase that to two to three in the coming months, because intel is the engine that drives our response. We have to know who's involved, where to focus our limited resources to be effective. The school resource officer programs are definitely a great prevention, and I found it interesting they were talking about GREAT. We applied for a GREAT grant last year for Clark Middle School. We wanted to put four or five SROs up there to teach, and we were denied that funding. I guess they didn't have the funding because a lot of the resources have been diverted.
On that point, and then I know there are a couple questions. Back, I graduated in 1989 from Diamond High. We had school resource officers, Mr. Tomko and Mrs. McLaughlin, that were there. And my understanding was at that point in time, that was just a standard part of every school. But, boy, did they keep people out of trouble. I mean, there's no question that they would follow, monitor, make sure, call parents, do whatever was necessary. So am I misunderstanding that the resource officer program is new, or?
We had a program before that mainly was counseling, and it didn't survive. What I think what you're talking about is the school safety officers. They're hired by the district.
Yep,
they have been there for years. I know they were very effective down at Diamond. But, of course, the school resource officers or Anchorage police officers are addressed as police officers and have the full authority of police officers. The school safety officers mainly handle administrative violations and kind of order, within the school, whereas the school resources officers are more involved in the criminal end of it. And of course, we do prevention intervention things also and get to know the kids. And so that's the difference in the two programs.
Okay. And just on that point, what I would say I think that was so critical about their role is that they were not threatening. They had the ability to form friendships, relationships with at-risk youth. I had a brother that for a period of time was going down a different path, and they were able to reach out, I would say, to kids in a non-threatening way. We're not going to arrest you, but we want to know what has changed in your patterns, what's happening in your life. So are those folks still funded in the schools as well, or are the resource officers in place of that?
No, we didn't take their place, and hopefully we won't displace them because they have a very important function within the school,
yes.
Just as you explained. They know the kids, and hopefully the school resource officers, you know, we try to attract people for that program within our department that are flexible, that want to be there, that will form those relationships. We see it as a great recruiting tool eventually, you know, for us. But at the same time, school is not the same as when we went to school. It's not the same as it was back in 89, unfortunately. The kids these days face some real concerns, you know, as we've seen in national press here in recent weeks. And so while it's my hope that our people are out there, and I know this to be true because I've seen many examples where they've helped kids, you know, not in a law enforcement sense, but help them in different problems within their lives, that they're there. But the bottom line is we're there for school safety. And if someone brings a weapon, just like happened at Diamond a couple weeks ago, or like we took a rifle with a clip, I think, beginning of last year off an individual in the parking lot of one of our high schools, and we've had several incidents where we've had individuals over the past 4 years with guns, that those police officers are there and can put an end to that type of behavior.
Okay. Representative Wilson, Coghill, or Guerra.
Thank you very much. Are the people that are in gangs, do they stay in school? But, I mean, after a few years, then maybe the head gang person would be older. And so do they try to recruit? I mean, I'm wondering about the level of education for these kids. And do we see them in school, or do they drop out and then they...
Of course, it varies amongst the different groups, and things change. Like I said, these groups are fluid. They change names. They change formation, not infrequently. But, yes, some of these people are involved in these groups are in our schools today, and some of them are suspended and expelled. But yes, there are some that are in this lifestyle involved in some of this behavior in our community. They're in our schools as we speak.
Representative Guerra?
Thanks. Just on the school resource officer issue, the importance of it is something actually the former principal at Clark taught me about before I ran for office years ago. And she talked about how they're used to get in contact with parents whose kids are truant, not only just in school, but... and then when they show up at a parent's house, the kid wasn't truant anymore for a long time after that. But I didn't realize that. And you have them in every middle school, right?
No, we have 16 presently, one supervisor. They're assigned two to high school, with exception this past year. Of course, we had Eagle River High School open up with Chugiak, and we decided that given our call load and because of work relation, we moved one out of the Eagle River into Clark Middle School.
So do you have them in enough middle schools?
We only have one in the middle school. The way they're laid out is two per high school, with the exception of Eagle River, which has one, and that extra one's assigned to Clark. They're supposed to handle the police calls that come in from all the middle schools that feed into their high schools and the elementary schools that feed into their middle schools. Of course, that doesn't always happen, but that's the design. We want them to handle the police calls, be police officers, because that's our expertise. Law enforcement officers, and to provide that support to the schools. And we find that where they're in the school day in, day out, just like if you and I work together day in, day out, I'm more likely to do a better job follow-up because I know I'm going to be seeing you the next day than some officer that they may not see again and comes in for a call once every 6 months because he works different shifts or different days off and things like that. So,
Mr. Chair, a little explanation on the history of SROs. I know it's been presented before. The way it started was through a grant. It was funded for a set period, I believe 3 years initially. The additional schools is another three. After the third year, the following fourth year was under the regulations or the contract of the grant, was that the municipality had to go at least one additional year after the grant expired. So it's up to the community whether or not they want to support or if there's
right.
funding from the state or the city to continue this program. And of course, you'll hear at different times of the year whether or not it's a popular program or whether someone thinks that the money and the resources are spent appropriately. We believe it is. We believe it is working. That's the position of the department.
How short are you, in your view, in the middle schools on school resource officers?
We only have one established at the middle schools. We find we spend most of our time around the high school and different things, but we do get to the middle schools, and we do get to elementary schools. One of the major things that I wanted to do for the elementary schools is truancy. Just as you, that's a very good point there. In fact, a couple of the schools I've gone recently have focused on truancy as a young man or young lady that's truant as being a big red flag to future criminal activity. And a couple of these different schools that I've gone to is a prevention for gangs, a strong truancy program. And I know last year, because I keep statistics when I was lieutenant, have them keep statistics, that we did 380 home visits with the school resource officers. We only wrote a few tickets, but we did 380 visits. And the value of having a police officer as opposed to a school administrator go is that sometimes there's usually a reason why they're truant. It could be because they have one parent that has a substance abuse program. There could be some other abuse going on at home. And, you know, there's been more than one occasion when we've done home visits where we've ended up calling OCS and taking the kids because they're living in conditions that, you know, just aren't very good. And, however, I've talked with the superintendent, and we're going to take a look at the truancy legislation. We may be coming back in front of you and back in front of the assembly to tighten up some loopholes. We're finding things like a lot of parents are saying, well, I'm homeschooling, you know, the kids and things like that, and some other areas that are problematic for that truancy law. But I think it's an important area where we need to focus on the, you know, intervention and prevention side of it as far as law enforcement, because if a kid is not in school, doesn't get an education, the chances of them being able to succeed or fall into this type of lifestyle, of course, you know, a lot higher. And so I think it's critical that we try to get them into school.
Thank you.
It's really important that there's often a pressure on you guys to come to us for stuff that doesn't cost money, and we have to make the decisions ultimately. But I hope if you're going to come to us on the truancy issue and you feel that you need more school resource officers and the city can't afford them, you tell us what that
right.
shortfall is so we can look
right.
at it.
Well, that's the major I was excited about coming today, because we need to be a partnership. There needs to be, and we're going to talk about the justice system in a second here. And resources, while legislation is important, resources is critical for programs. At the beginning, to get some of these kids off that conveyor belt that come down
mm-hmm.
towards us to try to intervene in that. And then the ones that get through, they're out there shooting up our streets and our neighborhoods, we need to put them away.
And Representative Garrett, did you bring up the point about suspensions and what happens with kids there? Just on that point briefly, and then we'll keep moving through. Something I never understood is why the school system, and that's a partnership that we, I think, need to work for in terms of resources. If a child's doing something to be suspended, why are we rewarding them by sending them home?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that, and this was brought up, I think, a couple of weeks ago in the paper, but is setting up programs at school so that they're forced to come into school and do homework or do other things, but sending them home to get in trouble all day just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And sometimes it's as much as 2 weeks.
And Dean and I have had some discussion over this. And, of course, being a former lieutenant in charge of school resource officer and working closely with the school administration, and I don't want to speak on behalf of the school administration because that's not my place, but I know that funding for that type of programs is an issue. Security, are you going to put people from different groups that maybe, you know, the night before have been shooting it out on the street? Are you going to put them into the same type of thing? So these are some of the problems that we face there. And then on the other end of it, you know, the one area that I talk with the chief all the time and different people talk about the school, the one place that we need to protect are the kids in our schools. And like I said, unfortunately, this element is in our schools. And the people that are involved in this type of element, if they're involved in violent type behavior in our schools, need to be away from the other kids in that school who need to have a safe environment so they can learn.
And I understand that, but the problem is the cycle continues. So you've got a kid who, you know, and remember, I'm still thinking about suspension for backtalking, not gun violence. But that being said, whatever the reason is, now you say, well, you're suspended, and on top of it, your homework doesn't count. So now your grades go down. So now you're failing in school. Now you don't want to go to school, or you drop out.
Right.
And the cycle just goes on and on and on.
Right. No, the concept's a good one. I'm not disagreeing. It's just a matter of working out, you know.
You're just sort of saying.
Right, the funding and security and the other problems with it.
Exactly.
I mean, the concept of just not turning them loose into our community is one I agree
critical.
With.
Critical. Coghill and then Gruenberg. Pass. Gruenberg? Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah. One of the bills that we passed that I think was a good start was Representative Anderson's bill on bullying. And one of the schools in our district, it's Ptarmigan School, part of the kids, some of the kids are from Tom's district and some of them are from mine. And we've received some reports of kids getting bullied. I'm focusing back on the birth of the gang-related activities. When I'm talking about gangs, I'm talking more, you know, it's tough when you have a drive-by shooting or a mobile platform shooting or whatever you'd like to call it today. The question isn't whether they're part of a gang as much as what's going on and what can we do about it. And in this case, how can we stop people from getting into that sort of thing? And I kind of think it's a continuum that kids start when they're young in the elementary schools, and then they progress to the middle schools, and it goes on from there. And we were talking, this is a sort of a long introduction to a short question, and I hope a comprehensive answer from you.
Okay.
The question is, you know, the SROs, the school resource officers, are in the high schools, and occasionally you get one down to Central. I mean, not to Central, to Clark Middle School, which is in my district too. But you don't get them down to Ptarmigan, where the bullying starts. And my question is, what can we do with that concept, gentlemen, to get them down to where the bullying and the, you know, the whole syndrome, like Representative McGuire said a minute ago, start. You know, you get them into this lifestyle where they're getting suspended and it's a vicious circle, and bullying and bullied, and then they form their own maybe retaliatory groups or whatever. And one sergeant for 16 officers, that seems way beyond the span of control normally. I mean, that's just not enough supervisors for that whole thing. What are we going to do about that?
Captain, we're talking kindergarten cop. We're hiring a lot more APD next year.
And directly from there to governor.
Cool. You're right, 16 to 1 is a large span. I'll work backwards. 16 to 1 is a large span, but, you know, 16 officers, a sergeant, and a part-time lieutenant is a mighty big commitment on the part of the Anchorage Police Department. When we're calling in four or five officers, sometimes on a shift, we're short in some areas and detectives.
Alcoholic.
And it gives you some kind of indication of our commitment to this program and the value that we see in this program, that we're willing, as a police department who has staffing problems, to commit 16 officers, a sergeant. Those officers, and I'll try to make this brief because I could go on quite a long time about the school resource officer program, but they're responsible for those elementary schools that feed in the middle schools, that feed in the thing. And in their spare time, a lot of them teach, I shouldn't say in their spare time, but some of them teach DARE, which has an anti-bullying aspect. We have some of them that are aggressive victor and bystanders instructors that teach in the middle schools, and they have some programs in the elementary schools that some of the officers have taught in. I forget how many presentations we did last year, but it's in the hundreds with the school resource officers. So we're trying. But however the workload is with the calls, that which is important for us to handle in the criminal arena, and the number of schools, I think we serve 80-some, 88, something like that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with 16 officers, we're not going to be able to do that. We have other programs where we've got go-karts with governors on them. We do a DUI presentation about the evils of alcohol and driving. And then we take them out. We set up a course with our traffic accident van, and we have them go through that, you know, driving with goggles on that simulate 0.10, 0.15, 20. So that's some of the things that we're doing on the educational side, because we see the value of that, you know, for the police department and the community. And like I said, we applied for the great grant. We do DARE. We do some of the other bullying programs. But, yes, there's more we could do with more people. But right now, with the problems that we're facing in this community, and you've heard some of the debate because you live in this community about how we're using resources, possible audits about how we're using our resources right now, we're pretty stretched. And 16 officers and a sergeant is a mighty large commitment on our part.
Okay, let's keep moving through. And then just to let people know, we're going to hear from Dean Williams, who's the co-chairman of the Mayor's Gang Task Force, as well as we're fortunate to have Mao Tosi from West High School here, who's got some real personal insight into the issue, the gang issue as well. So
I'm going to speed my presentation up because there's been a lot of good questions and dialogue here, but I think I'm about halfway through, and I sense I'm running out of time. So needless to say that we have several units that are focused on our the gang problem, and we're fairly comfortable we're getting to where we need to be, but we're seeing some other problems in the system, and I guess I'd like to move forward to that. Let's go ahead and just stop here for a second. This is what our special assignment unit has done. Those two asterisks, I think in that one down to Mulcahy Stadium, we had like 40 or some charges out of that alone. And you see we see 64 guns, so guns are a major problem in this instance. Next slide. Drugs they've assigned, they seized. Next slide. Safe streets, we talked about before. Presently we have 6 people assigned. 3 FBI agents, 3 APD officers. We see real promise in this unit. Next. Robbery assault, investigative support. Next. School resource officers, we've talked about that. Next. Next. And we talked about school issues. Here's some of the, I think this is a good slide to illustrate the difference between back when some of us went to high school and what the kids are facing now. You see on the right what in some schools, in some areas, young people are facing. This is out of Fullerton, California. Next slide. And you see what they faced in the past there. And, of course, it could probably maybe be a couple more things, but there's no question things are a lot more complicated and tougher for young men and women to deal with in our society today. Next slide. This is outside of one of our high school here. We're talking about problems in our schools. And here's the problem I talked about earlier that we face. I doubt that there might be one or two gang members or associates in there. But you see the dress, you see the hand signs, the message is pretty clear, and that's what I say. This is not going to be an easy problem for us to solve, and we're not going to get it done overnight. And like I said, unless there's a paradigm shift in our culture, I don't think this problem is going to go away anytime soon, and we need to work together on a united front, do what we can to try to keep it under control. Next slide. Project Safe Neighborhoods, we talked about that a little. It's a federal program, ATF, U.S. Attorney's Office, gun crimes. NIBIN's a new system where we take a lot of these shootings involve people. These people do multiple shootings involved in this lifestyle out there. A lot of times people don't talk to us on either side. We have great difficulty tying it together, solving these. This allows us to take shell casings, get them identified, put them into a system sort of like the fingerprint deal, and we can tie these different shootings back to one gun sometimes. So it's just another tool for us. Next slide. We talked about possible concerns. One of them that that we're seeing is it needs to be a two-headed approach here, intervention, prevention. But on the other side of it, we need to take these people involved in this violent lifestyle that are, show a pattern of violence, and we need to get them out of our community. We go through the federal system a lot because they actually take them out of our community 5, 10, 15, 20 years. However, we're seeing in our state system that's not the case. And some people that we don't believe, as in the police department, should be out on as low as bail as they get out on, commit other crimes where they're out on bail, or some people that are involved in violent crime getting very little jail time, we're not in agreement with that from our side. And we're not pointing the finger at anybody, because I think we need to take a look at the system as a whole, because in talking with the DA, who we work very well with, the juvenile deans group, we work very well together. However, the resources is a major issue. When we're handing hundreds, if not a couple thousand, felony cases to the state DA's office, in the judicial system here in Anchorage, the last 3 years was able to handle 26 to 31 trials, you see the problem. I think is in July of this year, they had 279 felony cases in queue. So you do the math, and that comes out to 9 years without a new case. I think talking with the DA, and I might not have these numbers exactly right, I think we had 28 homicides trailing, 19 for over 2 years. And I know we're taking a step in the right direction because they could get a couple new prosecutors or a couple new judges. We had the witness law that allows us to help us, aid us in the identify witnesses. I think it's been funded a new correctional facility out in Wasilla. So we're starting in the right direction. However, there needs to be a lot more done. And
can I get back to one point real quickly? Rehabilitation, just again, on that point, I recognize what you're saying in terms of removal from the community, but just getting back again to the average age, and you haven't actually given one, but my understanding is it's younger.
Right.
So 20, 30 years, that's pretty much, the whole start of your life. Is there any sense in trying to rehabilitate? And if so, what are we doing in our correctional system to try and get these individuals redirected?
Right.
Perhaps it's an early association with the wrong people.
Maybe that's a question better asked of Dean, since he's in the correction. He'll probably can give you better information on that. I will say that, we are looking at younger ages. We're looking 14 to early 20s, mid-20s mostly, for this type of issue. And I think certainly with property crimes and low levels of violence, first offense, we need to look at ways. We need not to put everybody in jail. I'm not in favor of that. But people that commit violent crime and show a pattern of it, I think we need to look at something like a three strikes law or some type of a thing like that where they just go away.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, that there may just be a point. I just always try to think about that is one prong of our justice system. And especially when you're looking at young offenders, you know, Max and Tom can tell you, but, from... And even in my part of town, but, we're not all fortunate in terms of who we get as parents. We don't get to choose them. We don't get to choose where we live, where we associate. And I don't know this, but, I have heard that sometimes you're either in the gang or you're shot or you're out. And so if that's the case, I just hope that we keep our eye on that fact, too. If it's a pattern of violent behavior that continues over a period of time, I agree with you. I mean, what are you going to do?
Being in a gang is not against the law, as far as I know. However, we try to focus not on the gangs, but criminal activity.
Yeah.
And, of course, we do have, what do you do with a 14-year-old? That's a very problematic question. You don't want to put them, away for 20, 30 years, but this 14-year-old's going around or 16-year-old's going around shooting people with no concerns and is not showing any, probability of stopping, and that's a problem also.
Yeah.
So, yeah. These are just some of the criminal histories that I pulled up. Next one. Next one.
What is a gang associate?
Next one. Gang associate, we have two different levels. A gang member, by our criteria, meets a higher level than a gang associate. Mm. And that's someone that, you know, we see in that type of lifestyle that hangs around with these people, but we have less justification given our policy. We can't call them a gang member because they haven't reached the criteria yet. They're in this lifestyle. We have reason to believe that they're probably involved in the gang, and they meet our criteria to make, call them a gang associate.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. How come there's so, I mean, what happens to the ones that are dismissed? Obviously, they, I mean, they...
Okay, just leave it there for a second. Well, you know, there's several, you know, I haven't researched these cases. Maybe it's because of us, the police. Maybe we didn't do our job. Maybe we made a bad search. Maybe we didn't make a good case. You know, maybe because it's because the prosecutor's office, because their lack of resources and lack of resources within the judicial system, you know, when you're getting thousands of cases and you can only try, you know, a couple dozen, you're going to make some hard choices sometimes. And maybe it's for some other reason. But that's what I say. We need to look at our whole system here from the police all the way down to probations and how we're doing business. Because the way we're doing business in the past is not working, and we realize that at the police department, that's why we're changing. You know, we're dealing with a very violent element here within our community, and we all need to take a look at how we're doing business.
Yeah, through the chair, if you have just a quick comment on the DA's office, if you've not experienced or seen how they process cases from the intake to the disposition, it's much like an emergency room triage. They take the worst cases, prioritize those, try to work with those, the more serious person crimes and such. The property crimes go largely, they look at, well, if we ever catch someone and we find someone responsible, then they can hold them accountable in two venues, the civil process or the criminal process, and they balance that out with, again, repeat offenders. If you've ever seen repeat offenders, the criminality, their defense attorneys, when they talk to their defense attorneys, they've learned through experience that if they go to the DA's office and offer up, I'll plead to one misdemeanor if you drop three felonies, it's essentially the bird in the hand with a couple in the bush, and often that's a trial that you may have to spend money and time and resources with a trial attorney or with a backlog court case. And so this is what happens often where we get to these reduced cases, dismissed cases, or real low sentence cases that they're trying to, if you will, clear the calendar, largely out of preservation of their office because you can see the inundated. We, at the Anchorage Police Department, we make about 300 arrests per week.
Gee.
300 arrests per week. You add more officers, that'll be more arrests.
So that's the
funnel in.
Right.
You know, I guess what's going through my head is thinking, well, if the first time you're caught doing something, if you suffer the consequences, you might not go back. But if you get off on it, then you go back and do it again.
I think that's very intuitive because what we're training in to a certain degree is there are no serious consequences to behavior until you get up to the point where you've committed a very, very serious crime.
And you go back to that sociality, what's going on in society, which is if you get in trouble, you get shot, you go to jail, there's some martyrdom there. You actually are seen as a larger figure.
And I'd just like to make one other comment. Fast forward a couple other slides because I know we're running short on time, but our major mission is the suppression end of the police department, so that's what I'm focusing on today. But intervention and prevention is just as important and needs just as many resources, so we don't always have to continue to put people away at the level that we're going to need to get a handle on this problem.
Representative Guerin, then Anderson.
Thanks. So this comes from the conversation I had the other day with former Chief Monaghan and Chief Hewn. I don't know this is exactly how they would propose it, but it seems to me their big thing is they're not able to do anything when they see gang members driving around in a car with weapons in the car because those kids are over 16, and the law only applies that restricts assault weapons and other sort of dangerous weapons to kids to below 16. I'm going to get in trouble with the NRA over this one, but I'm already in trouble, so what do I care?
You just lost their endorsement, right?
Yeah. I did that 3 years ago. So, you almost got me started.
another NRA moment. Of
not a shill for the NRA. So it seems to me that that's not going to work. I mean, if and I'm wondering whether we might be able to craft something that says if you're 18 or under, so you get those kids who are between 16 and 18 who are driving in gangs, if you're 18 or under and have a weapon in your car that's the kind of weapon that's primarily used not for hunting, right? Certain kinds of weapons in your car between 16 and 18, you can have your car forfeited if it's shown that you knew that weapon was in your car. Because the other problem the police officers have is they have the weapon in the car, and all four people say it's not mine. They don't know whose it is. And so the only way you stop this activity is to say, we don't really care whose it was. If you knew it was there, you lose your car. And so I'm wondering what you think of something like that, which is, you know, you have a non-hunting type weapon in the car. It doesn't matter whose it is. Your car gets forfeited.
I think that's something we need to look into. We are going to have a presentation to the chief here. We're looking at legislation around the country, and certainly guns in the hands of youth is going to be one of the areas that we're going to be looking at in general, along with some other type legislation. So that will be an area that we're exploring. We've had several requests from members of your respective bodies and from the Assembly for our opinion on legislation. There's a summit coming up. The U.S. Attorney's Office is doing on November 15th. It's going to be at the Marriott, and I'm not sure if that's going to be a topic there, but that was one of the things we were talking about also.
Just to follow up to the chair.
Yes.
Again, as Captain Cobb said, the chiefs have reassured, and then I think I said it earlier on, that there will be some legislative priority recommendations that will come from the department. However, something to think on in the interim, and maybe perhaps when you're considering possible legislation changes. If you recall the state laws that were changed on carrying concealed weapons, which in the state of Alaska, which actually extended deeper than what local legislation could allow for, which meant that the municipality essentially had a carrying concealed weapons law on the books, and therefore it was invalidated by, or at least most of the statute's language elements were invalidated by state statute. And the concern that you might want to consider in that is that if you apply this across all types of activities, such as smoking, which is illegal for under age 19 anywhere in the state of Alaska, such as alcohol drinking consumption, which is illegal under 21 years of age anywhere in the state of Alaska.
You can still strip.
And there's another, which is the local authorities to cities, towns, and villages in the state of Alaska, which can vote themselves in dry, damp, or wet. And so, therefore, if you look at that and use the same approach and logic and thinking, if Anchorage has a more serious problem than Igigik on gang activity and gun misuse and gun application, perhaps that legislation might be adjusted to allow that. That's just something to think about, certainly not a legislative priority that the chief has formally adopted. So this is something that might be considered. And I, for the record, I will say that I have taught carrying concealed weapons classes, the legal side of it, for years, and I am very much not against a responsible adult or a child with a responsible parent supervising them with any type of firearm. That is something that I believe is within the rights, both federally protected and the state.
Just to remind everyone, that was Representative Croft's bill. Representative Garrett.
Well, that was Croft and Chenault. And in fact, you know, I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that, you know, whenever the guys who come in and say, you know, we want you to do X because we want you to support the right to bear arms, these are the consequences, right? We used to have a law that let Anchorage have more strict rules on gun ownership and dangerous gun conduct. And then we passed this bill last year. I'm happy I voted against it. I was like one of three, I think.
And I was another.
And the bill said, no municipality can have a stricter gun law. Well, those are the kind of things that we have now done. You know, we traded the soundbite, I think, for a rule that is causing problems. You know, that and then the concealed carry thing was, you know, and this was Croft's bill, you know, you no longer have to get handgun training before you carry concealed. That was another NRA priority, you know. That's why I'm not one of their favorites. But I think the soundbite is dangerous sometimes.
Well, and I look forward, I think, what I'm constructing my own list, and I know others are too, but I look forward to seeing, you know, the white paper, if you will, that comes back that says these are some of the things that you can truly do as a legislature to help us. And some of it will be funding, some of it will be laws, and some of it will be controversial. And I do remember the discussions surrounding. And I know Tom's a big because his dad's a former head of the troopers. And, you know, I know that there's always that tension between some of the NRA initiatives and what you do, frankly, to craft a law that looks at the entire state versus local, maybe more urban areas. And that's something that we may have to look
right.
at.
I don't think we're opposed law-abiding citizens having
right.
guns at all.
Right.
But we just need to take a look, you know, how we can tighten up in this area.
Absolutely.
The final slide here, some areas for discussion. You know, we pretty much touched on a lot of it. You know, strengthening the adult and juvenile systems. We are working, like I said, very well with the state DA's office. We're talking about some innovative ideas to tighten up, but they're going to need more resources to combat this problem. The juvenile justice system, of course, the word punishment doesn't appear in there, and maybe it's a time to look at, you know, and I'm certainly not advocating that we put kids, you know, that have shoplift or things like that in jail. I think, you know, the vast majority of kids need to go to programs and rehabilitative things like that, but when we have juveniles that are out there trying to kill other juveniles and citizens, you know, and have this mindset that they just don't care, then it's time to, you know, kind of look at that system, because that's one of the problems we have with the federal system. And you heard him talk earlier, the aide to that congressman, is juveniles, feds won't touch juveniles in the past, and I don't know if they'll get that legislation through. And, of course, that's been a difficult problem for us within the system. We work well with Dean's group, and sometimes they spend more time in NYC than they spend in the adult system for similar offenses. But it's something that certainly the juvenile system and the adult system are worthy of taking a look. We need to support community efforts and intervention and prevention. That needs to be just up there right with suppression, because that's part of the puzzle. It's just not one silver bullet that's going to solve this problem. I mean, we can certainly put a lot of these people involved in this lifestyle away, and we'll tamp it down for a while like we did last time. But if we don't stay on top of it and we don't find some way to short-circuit that conveyor belt that's bringing these thugs up to us, we're going to continually be dealing with this problem. So we're, as the Anchorage Police Department and the City of Anchorage, certainly supportive of anything you could do to put resources into intervention, effective intervention and prevention programs. New legislation, you know, we could maybe define gang members so it's unified across the state. You know, the state troopers' definition is the same as ours, because where I foresee this going in the future is there going to be consequences, and real consequences, to being a gang member. And there's going to have to be some probably definition there that everybody from Wasilla to Anchorage to Kenai is aware of. And so we don't have different levels of being a gang member, you know, within the state of Alaska. Possibly retooling some current laws. I know talking with prosecutors in the past, some difficulties using some of the current laws, and I don't know the specifics of that. And, of course, new laws. We're talking about maybe three strikes. We're talking about maybe some adjustments to our gun laws. RICO, you've heard that. And that I've read about that in some of the conference I just went to. There's some prosecutors out of Portland, Oregon, that face a similar problem. And they use the RICO law down there. And, of course, California has the STEP law. And those are all topics, you know, for a different day. And just want to thank you and, again, say that I think we're all in this together, and if we work together, we can certainly get a handle on this.
Representative Gruenberg and then Lynn.
At the request of the state troopers, I believe, possibly the Department of Transportation, the governor proposed a law that we took up in this committee and passed to enhance penalties in traffic corridors, and that's just recently gone into effect. The concept being that if certain illegal activity takes place in certain areas, there is heightened enforcement and heightened penalties. And what I'm wondering, since I live and represent an area that is a, and my people don't like it called, but it is a high crime area, whether maybe we should take a look at borrowing from that traffic corridor concept and enhancing enforcement and or penalties if certain crimes are committed in areas of high crime victimization.
geographic areas. I know, and that, but I don't think most of the folks in this room probably realize, but even higher than Mountain View are some areas, some intersections in Russian Jack that are just little pockets of terrific violence. And, I mean, this isn't compared to other places in the world, Simolia and stuff, but, I mean, it's compared to other areas in Anchorage. And what I'm wondering is whether what you folks would think about us protecting people who live in those areas by maybe enhancing penalties if crimes are committed in those areas.
I'm all for protecting people in high crime areas. In fact, we did a, you probably know, we paid a considerable amount of overtime this summer when the level of violence was getting out there to have five officers working overtime in Mountain View, South Mountain View, and the Muldoon area with a supervisor on weekends and two during the week, and we're still continuing. I think we just recently stopped that. That's an interesting concept. I don't know the legal challenges to that, but that's certainly one thing that we could look at. I think is there's not going to be, like I said, one easy answer. It's going to have to be a comprehensive package, but that's certainly something we could explore.
If I might as well to follow up, Bud. It is a good concept for strategizing on essentially response to concerns or maybe proactively putting more resources to an area that's more concentrated. However, we believe as enforcement officers, the law is the law, and we should be able to enforce that equally across the city or the state. However, all people are entitled, if you will, to the same protections and the same laws. Given that, of course, using strategies to concentrate on areas in enforcement, perhaps that might be something that you could actually coordinate together with other entities to prosecute and maybe tag it as something that they want to look at it a little more, maybe perhaps at the sentencing, looking at the fact that these people are victimizing a neighborhood more so than another. But I think it would raise concerns. I know in my work and experience that someone whose neighborhood is perhaps branded as maybe higher crime, perhaps that might drive the economy concerns of people either moving in or wanting to move out of a neighborhood that's that way.
Yeah, maybe it's not a great idea, but we got to think of everything.
Right. And one of the points I would bring up is this violence is not confined to certain neighborhoods. In fact, it's all over town, as you know, malls, movie theaters, right down the middle of, main streets on election day type thing. And so you could be driving home from the airport tonight and look at somebody the wrong way or cut somebody off, and next thing you know, you got incoming rounds coming your way. So that's the scary thing. It's not only a problem, while it may be a little more concentrated in certain areas, it's certainly all over town.
Yeah. Representative Lynn, then Anderson, and then coming up.
First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in. It's very interesting, very informative. I'd like to piggyback on our chairman's recommendation. I think all of us would like to see a hard copy list of very specific recommendations for what the legislature can do so we can either together or individually draft some kind of legislation to address these problems. It was interesting. I do confess I was born in California. Actually, I was born in East Los Angeles, and I went to school at the infamous Garfield High School, and that was a very high-crime area. Many, many gangs. When I was a kid, I used to go out in the backyard, look over the back fence, and watch the gangs fight each other. This was the Pachuco area, if you've heard that old term, probably a precursor to some of the things that we're seeing now. It's interesting, too, I was on the high school ROTC rifle team, and in the middle of this gang-infested area with all the Pachucos, we had 22 rifles we carried back and forth to school. No one said a thing. I am one of the people who voted for the recent changes in citizens being able to exercise their Second Amendment rights and carrying weapons, and considering the increase in the gang activities, it's probably a good thing that I can do that. I know that as a matter of course, many, many years ago, as a cop, I was separating Cain and Abel, that long ago. But I do know that obviously you're going to concentrate efforts where the crime activity is. You're going to. I know I was a cop in the city of Tucson, and we had fewer people out in the east end of Tucson checking in their stolen garden hoses than we did in the high crime areas in the inner city. That's just common sense. Gang members, like everybody else, have these moving platforms, as we call them, and they drive all over town and shoot people. And we have to do what we can to make so people who are not gang members can take the kids to a ball game, take our kids shopping or whatever, without being caught in gang crossfire. I was in a combat zone in Vietnam. I used to get paid for that. I don't get combat pay here. Neither does anybody else. So that is a long way of saying that I think everybody here understands the problem, and you certainly put it more into focus. And everybody here wants to address the problem. But we want to have, there's some things the legislature can do, some things we cannot do. And if you give us the kind of a shopping list to go down that we can consider, because we're on your side, it's a matter of survivability. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I echo what Representative Lynn stated, and I want to thank you for not only noting that you're obviously here as law enforcement for suppression, but also for prevention and for all those that are, encompassing those activities. Representing Muldoon, as Max has alluded to, and its sister, brother, whatever you want to call it, Mountain View, we've run into these problems for years. I grew up there, and I want to give a quick example. I know we have other folks speaking. This summer, Dad, former head of the troopers, was coming out to his truck as I was bringing the baby to be babysat at my folks' house, and two neighbors, adult neighbors, come running over and say, "Hey, see the kids walking down the street? They just took a bar and smashed your brand-new Dodge truck in." About three different dents. And my dad said, "You've got to be kidding." And way farther down, we see these teenagers. And he says, "Well, Tom, let's call the police and let's go in pursuit to grab them because I want to bring them back." And then the two neighbors said, no, closer. Do you see the three little girls?" And there were fourth graders. And it wasn't the teens. And I want to compliment also APD because you had two different law enforcement officers respond within about 5 minutes. They were there, and they said, "We're going to bring them and talk to their parents." So I would say not only do we as policymakers recognize what you've said and want to partner and are looking for ideas, but for the next speaker, maybe we can be given some instruction because Lisa and I were kind of shaking our heads. Do you be too tough? Do you be too light? Do you talk to the parents? Do you talk to the church? And I think you shake your heads, too. It's really hard. Do you put
the
fourth
grader in jail? Touched on a whole different area there, too, property crimes. We do a pretty, being a captain of detectives and being in there for a few weeks and having my time to look around, we do a pretty good job when it comes to people crimes. We're staffed up in those areas, If they can be solved, we usually solve them in the area. But property crimes is a big area with lots of repeat offenders. So that's a whole, that's a whole different.
Well, thanks for good work.
Thank you very much.
Through the chair, if I could, in closing, I brought two pamphlets today. One is on the Parent Network, which is a local program that was adopted several years back under previous administrations. But the other one is, it's actually a National Crime Prevention Council copy that we've made on what's a parent to do about gangs. A lot of the information is still relevant today on what to do as a community, what to do as a parent, and some information. I draw your attention to the fact that, and the reason I bring this up is, as I mentioned earlier, I'm an implant from another state through the military. My father, we were here in the 60s, rock and roll with the earthquake, 63 to 66. Came back in January 76. I graduated at Bartlett High School, and I think we talked about the openness and carrying. I mean, I used to carry a folding lock blade knife in my belt, and it wasn't a problem. We used to take them out, sharpen them in the hallways, and no one really had a problem with it and concern. It is a whole different era that we're dealing with. And I can say only add that as a parent of two and now a proud grandfather of a four-month-old, there's a problem in our community, and I don't really think that the citizens of our state, and it's difficult for me to separate as a spokesperson for a department officially, but as a citizen of the state, is that we have a problem, and I don't think it really matters whether it's the government that that puts forth the program or the efforts, or whether it's private industry or a faith-based program at all. Mm-hmm. Someone's looking for leadership. Someone's looking for direction. The state's looking for direction. And I think it's going to take a lot of courage even to go past boundaries that we would normally and traditionally think, because this is a bigger problem that we really fully recognize and has explained today. So thank you for your time.
I didn't know a fellow golden bear was in my midst.
Yeah. Well said. Well said.
Madam Chair, maybe
it's... Yes. Briefly, and then I want to go to Dean Williams and to Mal. Yeah.
And I appreciated the chair holding this hearing and you folks coming. This year is, for me just personally, a lot different than any other year going door to door. I've had no less than three people personally tell me they were assaulted, and I've had two mothers tell me their children were murdered. And coincidentally, one of them was a family whose the son was murdered across the street from the Boys and Girls Club this summer, the boy. And the other circumstance was not gang-related, and I will take a moment. I went to a trailer a couple of days ago, and the young man was 18, and he said he couldn't vote because he was on a long-term probation. And I noticed he was wearing an ankle bracelet. And then the next day, I was still in that trailer court, and a mother said her son was murdered by a friend, and I said I thought I had met the friend. It turned out I had. It was a horrible situation, a lot of remorse.
Okay.
So not everybody's gang-related, but I find out just much higher from first-hand experience level of violence, and whatever you folks can do would be of great assistance, and really appreciate
just
it.
One further thing to clarify. We heard from the aide that there were 1,500 homicides in L.A., and, of course, I run the captain's captain detective, so I can tell you that we've had one gang-related or motivated homicide this year and maybe one other. While we've had a lot of shootings, a lot of high-profile things, we're certainly not yet at the level where they are in L.A. and Chicago, and people shouldn't be afraid to send their kids to school or go out in the street. But if we don't get a handle on this, it's clear where we're heading. And that's the predatory gangs, turf, more violence, so on and so forth.
Well,
and it's due to you, large in part, that you suppressed
it. Yeah, and the other thing I want to say, too, is that people tend to view it as one part of town or another. And, you know, I represent South Anchorage, and this is the first time in 6 years that I've been out in neighborhoods and heard people express a genuine fear for their safety in their neighborhoods. And
right.
Diamond Center, of course, is right on the edge. So this really, although it can be more prevalent in parts of Anchorage, I think it's important to recognize that the fear, the concern about it is spread throughout Anchorage. And the reason that we're having the hearing today is the recognition that there's a partnership that you have alluded to. It's the faith-based community, it's parents, it's schools, it's the municipality, the police force, and certainly there's a role for the state.
That's right. You know, parents are key, but if you have dysfunctional parents, I guess that's where we come in. And you're right on when you're talking about this isn't located one part of town. Just when we had those two individuals were out on bail restrictions from the shooting on Election Day, we took them down in Eagle River. And, you know, we're starting to see things move that way, and it won't be long with the efforts that we're doing here and just the way the demographics and the population that you're going to be seeing it in the Valley, Kenai, places like that.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Okay, Dean Williams. Really appreciate your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Dean Williams. I'm in my real day job. I'm a juvenile justice superintendent at McLaughlin Youth Center. I oversee half the programming there. And I'll start off with a few comments, but I want to make sure I have ample time to sort of answer the questions and have dialogue, because I think that's helpful for all of you as well as for me to maybe understand what you're looking for as you approach the next session. In November of 2005, I was asked to be part of the Community Youth Violence Gang Response Team, I have to look at every time I say it because who can remember that, by Mayor Begich to give recommendations on the youth gang problem in Anchorage. I eventually ended up being the co-chair of that team, and we issued a report in June of 2006, and I think that packet or that report is in your packet in front of you. Part of that, in research and reading and exploring the issue here in Anchorage as well as what other cities have done, we issued what we thought was a sort of a good start on the not only the suppression, but prevention and intervention piece in terms of what we think should take place here in Anchorage. After this report was released, I was actually called by the American Prosecutors Research Institute, which was not only interested in our problems and recommendations, but interested in how they may assist us. through a series of emails and conversations, I assembled a small group of lead agency personnel, and I won't go through that, but there were seven of us all the way from the U.S. Attorney's Office to Captain Cobb, Susan Parks, the Deputy Attorney General, and there were seven of us and lead folks that went to San Diego to a conference that was sponsored by the American Prosecutors Research Institute. That conference was called Community Prosecution. Community prosecution is really about how cities and communities have worked to attack certain gnarly issues in their cities, such as drugs, vandalism, and gang violence, through innovative and community-based approaches. A particular module of that training dealt with gang violence and what other cities have done and what other advances they have made in tackling that problem through suppression, intervention, and prevention. All of this work has kind of led us to where we're at right now, and before, clearly what has recently been happening among the agencies is that there's been a long history of what APD has done in terms of the enforcement issue, and I think what one of the switches is occurring right now is that there's a real strong collaboration occurring among the lead agencies about what we need to do, not just on the suppression issue, but the prevention and the intervention issue as well. So that's led to a number of different things, and one of the very first recommendations we made in that team report that we gave to the mayor was the establishment of a steering committee at the local level that was going to involve cross jurisdictions to oversee the effort. Because our trip to San Diego reinforced this. In fact, one of the councilmen from San Diego, as he got up to speak about what San Diego has done to deal with their gang and violence issues, started to launch out of the OJJDP model about how cities deal with gang problems, which is you must have an overarching steering committee from different agencies that can make influences in their agencies and also bring pressure to bear on each other as well as the other institutions outside of them to say, how are we all going to attack this? Because one of the issues that we have here in Anchorage, I think, which has occurred elsewhere in the nation, is you have a lot of great ideas funneling up for how you're going to attack certain issues and certain problems, and we don't have any way to coordinate that, and we don't have any way to sort of monitor it and get the agency people together to really go eyeball to eyeball with each other about, what are we going to do over the next 6 months or a year? And so we put that recommendation to the mayor down as number one, and what we learned in San Diego reinforced that a great deal. And I'll continue on. I want to make sure that I kind of get through a couple of things here, but if you have some questions about that particular item, I can't really emphasize enough that steering committee concept and how we get a handle on not just the suppression piece, but how we have the lead agencies together and get a model for getting those efforts centralized and then bring in all the good community players who have very many good ideas. And I've sat on a couple panels right now that have feedback from the community about those recommendations, and one of the things that we hear are some very good ideas and very innovative ideas and what we should do, but we have no way of funneling it right now. We have no way of organizing it.
So just on that point, when the recommendations come to the legislature about what state efforts are needed, you should probably look to that coordination as well. In other words, you could be getting recommendations from all kinds of sources, the right hand not talking to the left.
not only in the state, I mean, this happens somewhat in the state system as well, but especially across federal lines or municipal lines too. So that one of the things I'm asking that we keep on our radar, that all of you might keep on your radar, is that any efforts that come down regarding this steering committee, or if you hear that buzzword, or if you hear anything about those efforts, because there may be some costs associated with that effort, but if we don't have that cornerstone in place, everything I have read across the nation about cities that have tried to combat this issue, if that cornerstone piece isn't in place, you can spend a lot of money and get very little results. And so a number of things happen when you have that piece in place that will not happen if we don't. That's about as down and dirty as I can put it, but it's very, very important. And not only that, but the research has shown that it's important, too, when you take a look at other research that has other cities have done without that piece in place. It's not a very good result. The other thing I wanted to kind of mention and ask that you be just briefly be mentioned, and then I'll ask some questions. There's been several discussions regarding the truancy in school issue, which was also mentioned in the team's report to the mayor and the importance of that. We've had some discussions upon that already, and there is clearly recognized, and there may be some things, I know that Captain Cobb has mentioned that as well, that there may be some tweaking needed regarding the school truancy issue. We're also looking, we also know, and Madam Chair, I think your point about it doesn't make a lot of sense to take kids out of the school and have no supervision or oversight is not lost on any of us. One of the programs that I oversee at McLaughlin is the Community Detention Program, which is designed to be an intervention and prevention program for kids who are in detention or almost ready to go into detention. And one of the other programs we operate on a very small basis is a school suspension kind of program where kids can't make it elsewhere in the school system. This is not, I've made it real clear, not a school district's problem. It is a community problem because there's no way, as Captain Cobb clearly points out, that they can solve that problem on their own. Again, this goes back to the function, I think, of the steering committee, though, and how agencies work differently together. There's one other plug I'll kind of put in regarding a lot of the efforts that are kind of getting going right now, and that is that this collaboration, in my experience, I've been a state employee for 25 years. I've heard the word collaboration more times than I care to be honest, because usually it doesn't really mean a lot. It becomes a pretty word that doesn't have a lot of feet under it. In this particular case, I think we have a very good start. I'm really excited, too, like Captain Cobb is, that I'm here, because all of you are trying to get information and try to figure out which the best way you should handle things at the state level and the legislature. That's very exciting for us, because if anything that's occurred in the last few months that I've seen is this really strong attempt among the agencies, all the way, I said, from the U.S. Attorney's Office to the mayor's office, those of us in juvenile justice, APD, and other partners that we have not yet pulled in that need to be, but we have a good, strong start about saying, what can we do to handle a particular issue? And the truancy issue is one of the lower-hanging fruit, but the expulsion and suspension issue is one of those that is very close there. It's a little bit more difficult to manage because you do have all the issues such as the security and bringing gang kids together, especially, is not a good idea unless you have a real good plan in place about how you're going to handle them during the course of the day. Does it need to happen? Absolutely, yes. We are currently operating in juvenile justice on a very small scale, but that has given us some experience about what to do, I think, in the future. So that is not lost on any of us, believe me. And the last thing I'd like to mention that is in the hopper that we're working on is this issue regarding very serious offenses by juveniles who fall under the automatic waiver law. I'll explain the problem, which most of you are probably aware of, but and I don't want to necessarily bust out the solution yet or suggest, and I don't have one, and I don't want to represent my own division regarding what we're proposing about that. But I can tell you we've already had a small group has been assigned to it. I've been on that group as well, and we've been meeting with national experts to discuss the issue about 14 or 15-year-olds who come in with very, very serious felony crimes. Some of those are homicide, and right now the system either takes them down one track or down the other. They either go down the juvenile track, all the way down the juvenile track, and they get to 18 or 19, and we don't know anything about them past that time period. There's no supervision. There's no oversight past their 19th birthday in most cases. Sometimes we get them until 20. Or they go on the automatic waiver you know, that kicks in, or the discretionary waiver kicks in, and or if they're 16, of course, they need to go in the automatic waiver route. That has led to a couple of cases where we've had 14 and 15-year-olds come in, and one has gone discretionary and one hasn't. And the reason why that there's a problem right now that I see in this area is that we don't, it's either all or nothing in terms of some very serious sanctions. And that's the reason why the dual sentencing law that is currently on the books has some problems in terms of how it's enacted. And usually if you see how it's enacted in a juvenile world, it's usually because the defense attorney has brought it forward to the system because they don't want the possible adult waiver that might exist for that juvenile. And so they're doing everything to two-step to allow the dual sentence law to be enacted. Otherwise, there's some tremendous problems with it, though the concept is very good. So I'll leave you with just to say this, that a small group has met on it. Mm-hmm. We're discussing it with national experts. We know it's a problem, and there's a couple cases, of course, that in my own mind I have, having been in this system for a while, that are sort of poster child cases in terms of what has happened with crimes very similar. They're both homicides, and what has happened to one juvenile and what has happened to another. And there's a problem there. We are working on what the solutions are. We have some ideas on that. I'm not prepared, or I want to sort of, I can kind of dance around this to a certain degree about what some of those look like, but we are working on it. We're talking about it, and that also is one of those things we are taking back to the steering group that's already loosely formed, but I anticipate the mayor will announce something on that relatively soon. In fact, we're meeting to discuss it tomorrow. So with that, I'll remain quiet and answer any of your questions or anything else that I might be able to assist you on.
Excellent. And we've discussed in our committee over the last 4 years auto waiver, you know, for different crimes. And I know Representative Wilson has some more questions, but the concept of whether you're automatically waived into adult court or not and how effective it is or isn't. And I'm absolutely fascinated by this, and I'm hoping I won't be the chair of the House Judiciary Committee for sure, but somebody will, and hopefully I'll be in the other body. But whatever way, I'd love to hear that report about how that is playing out in reality, who's going down what track, and what the results are of that. It's something that we discuss a lot. Again, just kind of back to that ultimate prong of rehabilitation and then also punishment and whether the punishment's fair going down one track or the other. So
mm-hmm.
Representative Wilson and then Lynn.
Thank you. I'm sorry, but I cannot remember what the automatic waiver, is it age or is it crime?
It's 16 and with specific crimes, homicides obviously, kidnapping, sexual assault in the first degree, robbery in the first degree. There's a couple others I'm forgetting right now, but that leads into the automatic waiver, those particular crimes. There's discretionary waiver under 16, Representative Wilson.
Representative Lynn, and then Dahlstrom.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to put on my other hat here for a second. In addition to other adventures, I have been a school teacher, retired school teacher, and this on-campus suspension thing, you know, these kids do these horrible things at the school, and you say don't put them out on the street, but then they, it's not the function of the school to be wardens
mm-hmm.
of these kids. The function of the school is to educate everybody. And when these kids do these impossible things in school, you're cheating those who are not misbehaving. I taught for a year here at Romig, and I was a resource. With the severely emotionally disturbed students, worked with them, and they do these basically crazy things, and we send them to teacher, send them to the principal send them to on-campus suspension, OCS, I think they call it. Then they throw a chair across the room there, they come back to the resource room, and go back to the principal, at some point, they need to be out of the school. One kid even came back to me and said, Mr. Lynn, what can I do to get expelled? And I said, if you ever figure it out, please let me know, because I would like to help you. So, you know, the job of the school is to educate everybody. And so we've got to get them out of the school. And I know they can run around the street and do these things. They don't have any supervision at home, maybe because both parents are trying to make a living, both trying to work, both parents working, or maybe the parents are druggies and mixed up themselves. So I don't know what the answer is, but the answer is not going to be just to have the, turn the school into an adjunct prison.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I agree with you. In our team's recommendation to the mayor, we spent about a page and a half on that section. It's the longest narrative of any of the recommendations we gave, mostly to try to hit this down the middle. And you're exactly right. There's, as Captain Cobb has commonly reminds me as we get into this conversation, you know, we haven't had a serious shooting at school. We don't want a serious shooting at school, and we want to do everything to make sure the kids at our school are safe and who have a chance to have a decent education while the other problem, the troublemaker kids, don't upset the apple cart. We all got that. One of the problems we haven't addressed, and this is the reason I want to make it real clear again, this is not a school district shortfall or a problem. They cannot handle this issue on their own, and this is really a cross-collaboration issue. We must have a place, though, we must have a plan in place, I believe, that deals with some of those kids, because right now we're taking all those group of kids, and they all go in the same hopper. It's whether or not they've shown up with a gun at school or whether or not they've shoved a kid, and we don't have a very good system in place, community system in place, to deal with those kids who we may be able to pull out of that getting behind in the school. Now, not only did they have a bad incident happen, now they're short of credits, now they're out for a year, yeah. And where are they going to go? And we all know through all the research that's ever talked about this, low attachment to school, dropout. These are not only just high risk factors for gang activity, but for any other delinquency activity or violent crime activity. That's a clear established risk factor. Our problem is that we haven't had a very good system in place to deal with those kids. And if I was Carol Comas, I've talked to her about this personally. I do not fault her. In fact, I would do the very same thing approach that she has taken, is to protect the schools and to make sure that they have a system in place to take those kids out so the schools are safe. The problem is we still have those several hundred other kids running around unsupervised in the city. And that is the reason why we spent a page and a half in our recommendations to talk about that issue, talk fairly about it and not point fingers. And it is a process that it's going to take some work, but it is really one of the tool. It is one of the prevention areas that we most spoke about that we really need to get our heads around. And we got that. I also hear your point loud and clear, though.
Right. And just again, it's the school's function to educate, mm-hmm. and it's function of the police agencies to take care of that.
Well, and the middle ground, I think, is so fascinating.
We're looking for that.
You know, and maybe it's a matter of deciding, you know, serious mm-hmm. serious crimes, life-threatening crimes, if you will, versus others. But, you know, you think we do all these studies on whether early arson is an indicator, pyromania, cruelty to animals, and so on, as indicators of later criminal predispositions. And here we know right away if you've got a kid that's repeatedly, in a way it could be a cry for help, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And then the reward is go home, go to the Diamond Center for 10 days, and by the way, your homework will not be counted. So now if you were on the cusp of getting a passing grade, you're not going to now. So you have a lower self-esteem because you're failing, and on it goes. And so there is a middle ground, and I don't disagree with Representative Lynn, but you know, certainly you want to protect the kids, you want to protect that environment, but at the same time, geez, you've got your handle right around these kids that are in this area that could be, we could bring them the other way. Representative Gellstrom?
I'll pass.
Okay. And then Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Wilkins, you mentioned the dual sentencing. I'm not familiar with that, probably should be. What is it?
Microphone.
You mentioned the dual sentencing. It's
not surprising, Representative, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that you're not, because it was a well-intentioned piece of legislation, I think, that was meant to give some adult sanction in case a juvenile didn't make it in the juvenile system while they were going through treatment. Is it a system that says if you're sentenced under the dual sentencing statute, that you are beholden to the juvenile system to complete treatment until we get you till age 18, 19. Mm-hmm. And so you're sentenced under that, you're still doing your time with us as a juvenile, but then as an adult, if in fact you fail at treatment or you don't make progress and there's a hearing to determine that, a judge has an opportunity to actually impose an adult sentence. It is so seldom used because of the complication of actually getting the dual sentence option in front of a judge where both parties agree to it, and the reason why it very seldom happens, and I won't get into the intricacies of it, and certainly my cohorts in the probation section can talk more eloquently about why the it's so difficult to get people into this dual sentence option is because of the complications with the way the law is written, and so therefore it's never prosecuted that way in the juvenile world. It only is brought to us as an offer through the district attorney's office many times to avoid a waiver. So it's a kid spends his juvenile time with us, and he can be sentenced to the adult time in the adult world if he fails a treatment. In my 5 years recently here at McLaughlin Youth Center as one of the superintendents, I can think of happening one time where a juvenile actually was sentenced to an adult time. And even the number of cases over the last 5 years, I think there was one of our state office people ran the stats on this, and maybe there was 4 or 5 cases in the last 5 years, maybe 5 or 6 cases that were dual sentence cases, and they all came as recommendations from the defense attorneys to avoid any possible adult waiver issue.
Through the chair, do you have a cite on that?
I don't have a cite on the law. I can certainly, through the chair,
I'd appreciate if you can give my office a call.
I will.
And let me know. That'd save me trying to find it.
Well, and there's some...
if you have some suggestions on maybe ways we could look, and maybe now if it's 5 years, we should, as a legislature, possibly revisit it and see if there's a way we can make it work.
Through the chair, this is Representative Grunberg. This is exactly the reason why this small subcommittee in our own division has been having discussions with some of the national experts on this very same issue to understand what other states, other counties that had the same issue. And there's a number of different ways that some of those states and counties have gone. I know that we've had discussions about it. I know that this conversation is developing amongst us, but I'll certainly do what I can to give you the materials we have and bring you up to speed more on what the issues are.
I'm personally interested in if you'd like to have a legislator participate with you or be sort of involved in this. I'd volunteer for that because it sounds to me like something I'd like to know more about. I don't know if anybody else is at all interested, but I certainly would like to follow up on this.
Absolutely. Thank
Representative
you.
Garrett?
A couple of things. First of all, I don't know if folks know, but over at McLaughlin, they have a youth program that is nationally recognized. I mean, they have succeeded in turning troubled children into non-troubled children at a higher rate than most places. I think most places in the country, at least you're very well recognized mm-hmm. for it. So, mm-hmm. And I was very excited about you showing up, Mr. Williams, because when I sat down with Chief Monaghan and Chief Hewn, they pointed to you as the person to talk about this next issue. I think it's good. Or at least maybe they hoped you knew the answer. I don't remember if they thought you knew the answer or just hoped. What they had said was one thing that you're going to need to divert kids who are otherwise just being suspended, ending up on the street and ending up in jail, is a way to sort of target kids who are at risk for becoming gang members and getting involved in bigger trouble as they get older. And they talked about sort of a counseling mechanism that you could have within the school system where you could direct these kids to get them off of the gang track. And I said to them, is there any sort of counseling like that actually works? And then they said, speak to Dean. And so is there something that you would recommend in that area, this whole idea of additional counseling staff maybe in the school system to try and get kids off the gang track through the chair?
Just recently, Representative Garrett, we've had one of our units, our longer-term units, has done some work and some research on gang intervention, gang quote-unquote therapy, which I'm using that term very loosely. And our experience with that is sort of minimal in terms of implementing that at McLaughlin. We have caught up the same way with everyone else when you start going through the cottage programs or our long-term treatment programs to say, gang kid, gang kid, gang kid. almost a gang kid. And then you could go, right now I could take any one of you to the cottage program and say that kid is in here because we know he's associated with gangs, et cetera. And so our experience in terms of finding effective intervention programs is very new, though I know we have been working on that, and one particular unit has been looking at some of those programs. The key, I think, and I agree with the chief, this is the area where I'll go back again to the steering committee. We must have a way, we must have an agreement among all the agencies about this is how we're going to get kids into some of these intervention and prevention programs. If there's anything I've learned about this over the last year or so, is that not one shoe is going to fit all. And you must have a list of options for kids depending upon what they need to be plugged into. Otherwise, you're spending a bunch of money on an area that is not really what that kid needs. And best intentions, and we've done it ourselves inadvertently, where you develop a program for a group of kids and it matches them, but by virtue of that, you're shorting other areas. And so it's a matter of prioritizing and how do you get it coordinated. Right now, we don't have a very good oversight. And one of the other things regarding the steering committee is that we know there's going to be some expense because the other programs that only work with someone who's helping run this deal, who's helping the steering committee and helping the agencies come together and develop memorandums of understanding, agreement, and protocols. And so with that, I think there's some intervention issues that we could put in place. We just don't have the process right now of filtering out those kids and triaging those kids, the ones that we could work with either in our system or in the nonprofit or faith-based system, because there's also been an upswelling of people in the faith-based system and nonprofits who want to do something, and some of the best recommendations. I mean, we have people very anxious, very involved, who want to know where do I fit in? And you get them fitted in because when you have a structure that allows them to say, yeah, I got you in over here, and that's heavy lifting, but it's very, very important work. It's not very jazzy either because it doesn't capture the headlines, but you have to have that backdrop in place. I don't know if I've answered your question or not.
Right now, one of the shortcomings is you don't have a way to identify the kids who could benefit. Is there sort of gang intervention therapy that exists right now? And
through the chair, unless they come through our shop, unless they show up on DJJ's door, then we have systems in places. Unless they've been referred to us, yeah, then some things can start to kick into place. To answer the second part of your question, though, there are other options for kids, but we do not have identified yet a gang intervention treatment, a gang intervention program. This has been done in other cities. We have looked at them. We have looked at instituting one of those in McLaughlin's long-term treatment programs for kids who we have in our custody up to 2 years. But in terms of, like, if someone gives a phone call, hey, can I put my kid in a gang intervention treat group or something like that, do you have that in place? No, we don't have that in the community.
Just one follow-up. I think what the chiefs were talking about was, you're focusing on it, but this is after kids have committed a juvenile crime and they're at McLaughlin.
Yeah.
And they're talking about identifying kids before that happens in middle school, and I guess, is there any chance that your steering committee is going to look into that and come up with a proposal on that? I'm more skeptical that after, I'm more encouraged about catching kids before they end up in the McLaughlin system than after.
Well, through the chair, I am too, because it's no good having slightly delinquent kids hanging around with really delinquent kids. We all know that. And the yet-to-be-formed steering committee, those are one of the items that, you know, this deals with the school truancy and expulsion issue as well, but that is the other system that's going to be put in place is how do you identify kids and how do you have either who is going to spearhead the phone calls from community people who say, hey, I have a kid who's at risk of being involved in a gang right now. We don't have that. And that was also one of the other recommendations we gave in terms of our report, and one of our recommendations, we said we must have some sort of oversight. Some gangs are, it's loosely used in some other cities or counties, that is helping the steering committee in how that's formed. Because you must have, and if you look at other cities where have made progress, they have literature, they have suggestions, we're doing some of that, but one of the things we don't have is what happens when a public citizen calls and says, I have a kid who's we think might be involved in a gang. What do I do?
Right.
And then starts the long list of phone calls that they have to make to a whole bunch of agencies, to a whole bunch of people, and most of them aren't going to be able to steer them in the right way, unfortunately, but that is the truth of it.
And one thought, too, you might consider as you're looking at it, a lot of schools have the peer mediation programs in place, peer leadership groups and classes. Even at Diamond, they have a class that teaches kids to be leaders within their own school and recognizing things that are signs of violence, signs of problems, things that are going on. And it might be something to dovetail into that, is how to train those. And I'm not suggesting that a peer would go in and try to mediate in a gang issue, but that they might be trained in such a way or using those resources to sort of be identifiers of things that appear out of sorts within their own school. And the concept behind it is that adults don't always recognize, they aren't always in the cafeteria at the moment the conversations happen, they're not in the hall, they're not in the bathroom, the girls' or boys' bathroom when these conversations take place. And so it's the peer-to-peer contact a lot of times that really provides you with the information that you need. So that's just something to think about.
It's
a good segue for our next person, our final person, Mao Tosi, who's the head of the Poly Pride Club at East and West High School. It's got 100-plus students, and welcome, and thank you for being so patient.
Not a problem. I didn't know that I was speaking, so, yeah. But anyways, I have over 100 kids in my club. I guess I should tell you who I am and where I grew up, everything. I grew up in Mountain View. I went to Clark Junior High. A lot of these gang issues, they started around my time, around 1990, 91. When I was at Clark, he was talking, you know, our police officers were talking about a few problems that were going on in the junior highs. That was my time. Those are usually, some of those kids are my friends and still are, and a lot of them are in jail now. And, I went to Clark. I graduated from East High School, and I would not have left. I probably would have been someone that would have, you know, contributed to the gang problems if I didn't make it out of here with sports, and that was my biggest interest. And so I was very fortunate to be in sports and gifted enough to play. But, I went off to college. I played basketball and football. I played in the NFL for a few years, and I broke my neck, and that's what brought me back here. When I got paralyzed, first thing that popped in my head was, I want kids. I want to get married. And so I moved up here 2-3 years ago, and now I have 3 kids and another on the way. So
you're working fast.
Yeah, hey, gotta be. So I figure, you know, since I'm able to walk around, now I want to be able to play with them when I'm 40. And I thought there was no better place to raise kids than Anchorage, and I still feel that way. And since what I'm doing, or, you know, since I started having kids and everything, and it just came to me, you know, if my kids are getting everything that I plan on doing for them, then I think that all kids should get that. So now I started a program. It's called the Poly Pride Club. And what we do is I really try to find every resource possible to make these kids successful, whether it's in school or out of school. There are resources out there. There are programs out there that are going on, whether it's tutoring, whether it's anything. Anything they want to do, I'm there for it. The problem, I have 100 kids in my program. Majority of these kids are high risk for gangs. There was a shooting at the Anchorage football stadium. Those are my kids. Those are kids in my club. There's a lot of things, a lot of negatives that are going towards my program that are making it hard for it to be successful or to get going. And the biggest thing that I'm having problems with are finances. I have 100 kids, and I'm all by myself trying to work with all these kids. But my priority is my security position. I work as security at West High School. And I have about 70 kids over there in my program, and I have about 30 to 40 over at East. So I run 2 programs. Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm over at East, and Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'm over at West. And one of the things is we don't have a room to meet. We don't have any finances. But, I mean, just having a room to meet is our biggest thing. You know, if I can, we're in the cafeteria right now where it's hard to teach these kids anything because kids are running in and out of this place all day. But any of these problems that you hear about, I usually hear about first, because usually these kids come tell me right away what happens, so what's going on in the streets. So, yeah, I catch them. I a lot of these questions you guys had, I'm sitting back here like, oh, I got an answer, I got an answer. But now I'm up here, and now I'm all blank. So, so I'll just leave it right there as far as what I'm doing with these kids. We have a few businesses that we are doing within our club, and the goal is to build leaders, you know, build confidence, build pride. Majority of the kids are Polynesian. We have about 20 black kids. We have a few Asian. We have, because the main thing I want in my club, Poly means many. It doesn't mean Polynesian, but I am Polynesian, so majority of the kids are going to be Polynesian. So I'm trying to get all these kids into my club however I can. One of the biggest sells I have is that I am an athlete. And so, you know, football players, males, you know, male minority, our role models are, you know, we're very few. So one of the big sales that I have is, hey, if you play any sports, if you come and join my club, I will train you at some time during this time. You know, I'll take out an hour and work with you guys. So I've got like 50 males in my club just for that reason. So, but the first hour, though, is study hall, you know, because we have to occupy their time more than anything. A lot of these kids, they're running the streets because they're more successful at it. You know, it's more interesting to them to be on the street doing something negative than to be in a classroom learning about history, Alaskan history, or any type of history. You know, and, you know, these are, you know, the thing is, I try to support them in any way. I provide them all those resources. I try to do anything. Anything there is, it's out there. I tell these kids it's too easy to make money. It's too easy to do this or that. But I have nothing really to show them, just because everything I have to pay for, you know, to get more kids. Like, I should have over 100, 200 kids at each school, because the Polynesian populations in these schools are very high. But it's just the transportation, the finances. I don't have any of those things, and everything that I'm doing is out of pocket. So it's really just starting to come along. And the thing is, the more money I have, the more that I can impact these kids right now. I tell people, you know, truthfully, I don't need the money, you know, just because I know I will get this going. It'll take a year or two, but, you know, if I can get $10,000, I can get started now. You know, everything that I want to do is just that simple. It's just, we just don't have the funds to do anything. So it will get going, so you will see a lot of me around and stuff. So, yeah.
Madam Chair. I am really happy to meet you. I read an article about you in the paper, and I didn't know you were going to be here today. Are you incorporated? Probably not, as a 501c3?
No, I am. You know, I assume that being part of the school district, that I'd be covered under their umbrella as a nonprofit, but I'm not sure on how to go about doing all that.
Okay, so, but you could accept personal donations, correct?
Yes. The way I've been doing it is I've just been taking it, and just if someone wrote a check for me, then I'll just take it and just go buy whatever I need and then send them the receipt of actually what I bought and then just do it that way. But I've only gotten a few donations, and I've just got the receipts, and I send those out.
Right. Well, I, what I'd like to do is meet with you after we set up a time. I'm aware of an organization out of this state that funds programs worldwide that pertain to children, and there's millions of dollars.
Yes. There we go. We got the problem solved.
I would be happy to help you
go through the application process
and get that. And I just appreciate, and I appreciate your clarification, too, of the word Poly, because, you know, I mean, even though I know that because of a lot of Polynesian friends, my first association was that it was a Polynesian.
Yeah,
friend, but no,
yeah, and that's
everybody.
We have a lunchtime luau that we do at East and West every 2 weeks, and it's something that we do during school just to create student involvement. You know, I want these kids to learn more about our culture and experience our kids, and then maybe when they see them in the hallway, they won't be so quick to not want to talk to them, or, you know, just to open up. We're just trying to make kids more comfortable around all kids, you know. So I tell kids in my club, hey, if you're in my club, you got to deal with other people. They did not want white people in our club. And I said, hey, in order for you guys to be successful, you guys got to work with everyone. If not, go back to the islands, because, you know, that's not what we're about here. The whole goal is to make sure that these kids are successful once they graduate. And that is the goal, for them to graduate. I've got to raise their expectations, because their expectations are very low. And that is the biggest problem, is just their confidence. And we do have businesses that we are trying to run. We're just trying to get the funds to get it going. We have a school store which sells majority of, it's called the Poly Shop. So we sell, you know, let's say we're at West, we have T-shirts that we make at West, but it just has a Polynesian cultural design on it. And, you know, these are simple things, and these are things that can be run by the kids. And, you know, these are all things that, you know, where they learn their leadership skills and build their confidence and business management, everything possible. Just like I said, everything possible to make them successful.
Representative.
So, also, when we, I try to catch every kid. What I do is I email all the teachers, hey, if you got any problems with any kids, please let me know which kids these are. And what I do is just go talk to them. One of the biggest things is that I feel more comfortable around kids. And so they know that they actually come to me more than anything. So it's more of they're drawn to me. And so that's one of the biggest things, too, is that they want to be around me. They always, you know, and I make sure that they want to be around me. I make them comfortable. I try to make them laugh. I try to do everything possible. Everything possible.
Yeah. Representative Lynn, did you have your hand up?
Well,
and then Gara.
Maybe a little bit. Lunchtime Luau sounds good. I could be back.
Yeah.
Can we be invited?
Yeah. If you had a tax-free thing, for example, some people may have some leftover campaign funds.
Yeah.
A few, and but we, I don't think we could actually give any of those to you because the legalities are not there, right? And so if you get what would be a 501c3, have you ever thought? We have some attorneys I see in the room here.
I was thinking Max might volunteer to do it.
Yes, I want to participate with Nancy, if Nancy will spearhead this. And this can be done through the Anchorage Community Foundation and stuff. And I have some friends. We've talked.
Yeah.
And definitely, Nancy, I'd like to participate. Sure.
That's right, because if you could...
But we need to get them incorporated.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
You need to get them incorporated. Yeah. Then that opens up all kinds of doors.
Yeah.
To get funds.
Yeah. See, and thing was, I wasn't really. Once we get going, the way I see it is, I told these kids we want to create self-sustaining businesses within the club, so we don't have to go out and ask for anything, and that would be it. Now we would donate money. Now we're out in the community. We're really trying. I just wanted these kids to be acknowledged more than anything. They got to have pride in themselves in what they do. So, you know, when we have events, I've got to have the Polynesian organizations out there, the Polynesian community, they have to support these things. I haven't yet to, actually, I haven't, that none of them have come to see me yet. I've got 100 of these kids. If there is money out there that's going to these Polynesian organizations to help these kids, I have them all. There's no way that they should not be talking to me.
Representative Gara and then Dahlstrom.
The committee that's going to be out there to help you is going to get bigger than this committee. So.
Yeah.
So just before, were you on the East basketball team that was also nationally ranked?
You remember.
I remember watching you play.
those were the days.
The highest nationally ranked basketball team the state's ever had, Mal was on, so with Trajan and...
Yeah, I was Player of the Year also. I forgot to throw that in there.
Only
small one, yeah.
Still the Player of the Year.
Hey,
with
thank you.
My club.
One of the and I must say, if you're lucky, maybe he'll give you an autographed picture. I have one of those.
You do?
If you're lucky. I might have to take that back. We'll see.
I've never said publicly that after one of those games, I almost ran Trajan Langdon over and ended his career driving through a parking lot, but that didn't happen. And
driving issues.
I've had a lot of driving issues lately. I also know somebody who's been looking at trying to donate to sort of good community organizations like this, and I think you're gonna get some resistance getting government money, right? Because it's a Polynesian cultural club, and that's the sort of interesting thing about it. I think that the gang activity, as we learned before, you know, is somewhat segmented among different communities in town, and I think if we directed a lot of government money to one group over another, that might be a problem. But I think there is private money out there now.
Yeah, my program, a lot of the kids, like last Thursday, we had a meeting over at West. A few kids came in with red and blue rags, you know, these are things that I got to watch out for and stuff. And so a lot of these kids are doing things that are, what is it? I'm not sure where I'm going with it, but I mean these are things that I'm trying to, you know, to watch out for within my club, because we have to occupy their time. What I'm trying to do is provide them things that are more interesting than being in the streets. Everything. Provide incentives, you know, to motivate them to be in school. Why are they coming to school? I got kids. I got a six-year senior with 10 credits. You know, she shouldn't be there. So what I'm doing is I got to find the resources within the school, within the city, to figure out where I can put this female. And what I did was I sent her to my Career Resource Center, which is something that all schools have, and he's working with her. All I'm doing is just saying, okay, hey, you're not going to graduate. Let's figure out what you're going to do. And it's better for them to hear it. They'll listen more coming from me than it would be coming from you, just because of the connection as far as me being Polynesian, me being minority, me growing up here, and those things. And so, I mean, I have a lot of kids like that.
You're going to make a huge difference. You remind me, I said this earlier just briefly, but Mike Tomko and Mrs. McLaughlin, when I was in school, they were there. They just retired 30 years. And you remind me of what they did for us at our school. And they were such a resource. And it was just, it wasn't that they could do everything, but they had a way of communicating with kids. They could reach their soul and help direct them.
Yeah.
And sort of, I think, also be perceptive about things that maybe even a kid wouldn't reveal about their own life.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to make a big difference.
Yeah. I'm trying to break down walls as far as, you know, how they behave socially. One of the things that I found with these kids is they're quicker now to jump from arguing to shooting and skipping the fight. You know, they are quicker now to do those types of things. And what I'm doing is for 15 minutes we play chess. Chess works on them thinking ahead, you know, them making the right choices. And the main thing is just getting them to think that way. Okay, now, you know, if I get into a fight, what's going to happen? You know, it's just something that every day we've got to work on these things. And it's just chess. And I mean, it's something, it's a game. And everything that I'm doing is I'm trying to be appealing to them, but still trying not to give too much ground to them.
Representative Dahlstrom and then Wilson?
One other thing.
Oh, and sorry, Representative Garofalo.
I might run and not catch you. Right after this, I do want to talk to you. But before you go through all the effort of forming a nonprofit, which I think would be very complex, I think probably as long as you are working with the school district, as long as the school district has the commitment that if they receive money dedicated to you, they'll give it to you, people can give straight to the school district and it'll go straight to you without you doing the nonprofit.
What I'm trying to do, truthfully, is to get a position, I call it the urban liaison position, where I run through three schools, East, West, and Bartlett. You know, they have the highest minority populations in these schools. And what I would do is monitor all high-risk youth, all of them. So, I mean, whether they're Polynesian or black, white, whatever, I mean, I just feel I can make that connection between these kids. And so between that, though, I would work between the junior high schools and elementary schools where I would go into these schools and just talk to the kids. So once they do reach the high school level, they will already know about my club. They'll know about everything that I'm doing. It's just getting them ready for once they get there. Because a lot of these kids in high school, and the reason why I'm doing it in high school is to break a cycle that's going on. You know, these kids are leaving as seniors and not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
They're not knowing anything, truthfully. And so that's all I'm doing is stopping that from happening. And so once what's happening is a lot of these kids, they have little brothers and little sisters, little cousins. They all look up to these kids. You know, whether they're in a gang or whatever, they look up to this stuff. And they may not be associated to the gang, but if their older brother's a blood, most likely they're going to say, hey, I'm a blood too, you know, just because his big brother is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I can stop the cycle at that age, at the, you know, at the high school level, and then I take these kids that are doing exactly what I want them to do, I'm taking these kids with me down to the junior high level and taking them down to the elementary school level. Because they are their brothers and sisters, and they do know these younger kids. Because a lot of the kids over at my West Club, we have kids from Roman come over because their brothers and sisters are in my club.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, hey, I want you to come here every time. Any kids I run into or see that I don't know, I go get them. You know, I got to go and talk to them. I have to acknowledge that they are here. So all that is hey, how you doing? What's your name? What are you doing here?
Right.
Please, whenever you want, you are welcome in our club. So it's just I have to try to open my arms to everybody and anybody.
Great. Representative Dahlstrom and then Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's obvious to me that you act on your gut and your head and your heart when it tells you things. So can I trust also that when there's things that need to, that you become aware of, that you report them to the proper authorities?
Yes, and the thing is, those are things that I'm trying to figure out myself. I mean, what would I report? Because I don't want to get kids in trouble, and I'm trying to figure out ways to get them out of trouble. And one of the things that I was doing was I was telling my principals, hey, instead of suspending these kids, can you put them in my club? And I remember there were four kids that were suspended at one time, and I said, please, can you put them? Because I talked to these kids, they said, yeah, we'll join your club. And they were all suspended for 10 days. They were all friends. And so during this 10-day suspension period, what happened was one of the friends was sitting across from his other friend, and he shot him. So the kid died. This was maybe a month, 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And so this was at West. And so, I mean, that was something that I felt that I really could have made a difference. Because these were guys just hanging out. And that's the thing with the suspensions is we got to figure out what to do with these kids because suspensions are killing my kids. I had 7 suspensions last week within my club. You know, Polynesians have the highest suspension rate. That is the biggest problem that I'm having in the schools is the suspensions are
putting time on their hands and there's nobody watching and
and that's exactly it. There's just way too much time on their hands and everything I'm trying to do is to occupy their time, but occupy their time as positively as possible and teach them all these life skills, leadership skills, everything. Everything that I would teach my kids.
Yeah.
So,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you do this club? Is it just during school hours, or is it?
Yeah. See, I do security over at West, and so what happens is my job takes priority over my club. So they tell me that, but it's hard for me not to do my club. So all day, teachers are coming to me all day with any problems that they're having with any of the Polynesian kids. So all day, I'm always drowned with Polynesian poly club work. So it's and the other thing is when I go to East, I have to take leave time from West to go to East to run the club over there, and I don't get paid for none of this stuff. So it's really something that they're kind of supporting in the school district, but they're kind of not. So. Like, it's up in the air right now.
You know, I think what you're doing is wonderful, and I think and your heart's in the right place, but I don't think you can continue doing all that by yourself.
Truthfully, it's really easy, just because,
you know,
I mean...
I think you need to get some help.
Yeah, I will get help, hopefully, sooner than later, but, I mean, a lot of it is really just hanging out with kids for me. I mean, more than anything... If I know what's going on in their file, like whatever classes they're not in or whatever homework they need to take care of, and I go tell these kids, they'll listen a lot better to me than they would someone else, you know. So, I mean, it's more of parenting. So I feel like I'm nagging them all the time, but it's good, though. It's good for them. A lot of these kids, they don't get that at home. You know, majority of the Polynesian kids in my club, when they get in trouble, is the only time that they're acknowledged at home. So, and that's you know, in a negative way.
Yeah.
And so instead of going home and getting beat, these kids would rather run. And so even when they're suspended for 10 days and they come back to school, what's happening is they'll avoid going to class because they've been gone for 10 days. They don't know what's going on, and now they got to come in and take a test or a quiz.
So how much time out of school do you spend?
Well, this is actually counting this. Time away from school too, so I had to take a day off just to come here. And right now we go from 2:30 to 5:30, so we do that on Tuesdays and Thursdays at West, Mondays and Wednesdays at East.
And that's so. Part of your job, or is that
just no? What they told me was because I was working at the Whaley School. It's a step below Juvenile McLaughlin, and 3 days before I was hired, or 3 days before school started. They asked me to come to West. They heard that I wanted to start a Polynesian club. They wanted me to work with the Polynesian kids. And so when I went over there, they changed it on me. They said, oh, yeah, by the way, you got to work from 8 to 5:30, and you can't run your club anytime during your work time. So Then they switched my hours. Now I go in from 6 to 2:30, or no, 7 to 2, 3:30. It just depends on when my clubs are, because at East it's different times than it is at West. But pretty much I have to take leave time to do anything that I need to do with my club.
Yeah.
But just like I said, they're kind of supporting and kind of not. So, but, it, yes.
Representative Lynn is in Walter.
Right. Just to go along with what the Representative Dawson said a few minutes ago, I understand, kind of put you in a box. If you learn about somebody who's getting ready to go down, if you do nothing, that's not good. But if you report it, then you become a snitch.
Yeah.
And then they don't tell you anything. And so it puts you in kind of a box.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of judgment,
mm-hmm.
you know, when to go to the cops and
yeah.
say, this is going to happen. Do you do that, your names, dates, and places, or you just say, hey, something is going to happen over there. Maybe you all ought to be there. I mean, it puts you in a tough box, because if you snitch every time, then they're never going to tell you anything.
Yeah.
But if you don't do it, then somebody could get killed.
Yeah.
So it's lose-lose almost.
Yeah, I was asked, my wife asked me, why don't you become a police officer? You should be a police officer. I said, well, the problem with becoming a police officer is that I lose that credibility with these kids. Then I am not one of them. Then I am a police officer. So there was a police officer that I know. He's a Samoan guy. And I wanted him to come speak to my kids because he's a role model, a male role model within our, you know, people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked these kids, hey, you guys want so-and-so to come, you know, talk to you guys. He's a police officer. He's, oh, man, I don't want no cop coming. So he wasn't Samoan anymore. He turned into a police officer. And you know, it's just that. It's just that these kids don't look at it on the same level in any way. So now I just turned myself into an authority figure that they don't want to be.
Yeah, you're big enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
So who's
thank
buying you. Lunch?
Well, we're going to do luau.
Representative Doster.
We're going to do luau, right?
Hey, if you guys would like. Treat on Nancy here.
Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, no, I'm sorry.